This episode is brought to you by Podomatic, the easiest way for podcast fans to become podcasters. Go to podomatic.com or search Podomatic in your app store to start your own podcast for free and find your audience. Hello and welcome to episode number 374 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
We finally got here.
Yes, we've finally been able to record. There's been a lot of havoc this month, a very busy month for us. So we're recording this the latest we've ever recorded one of these specials. This will actually go up on New Year's Day. Happy New Year to everyone listening. We're finally here to discuss the year that was 2023, which I suppose it is fitting that we are recording this on one of the final days of the year. So we can finally look back on it and see what was it like for horror across film and TV. You know, it's been a very interesting one.
It has indeed.
And yeah, we'll be talking about our top 10, won't we, as our main event, as always. Mm-hmm. Our top 10 films of the year, and then we'll go over our individual awards for the year as well across all the different categories. And also there will be a big announcement at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that as well. The little precursor we normally have for our top 10, would you like some stats from this year?
I'd love some stats. That's what I've been waiting for like 3 or 4 weeks, is some stats, and we're finally here.
It's always interesting because I didn't expect a lot of these things. Like this first one is expected because we saw less films this year than we did last year. So we covered 36 new films this year compared to 49 last year. But there is a main reason for that, which we'll get to in this short little breakdown, which I'm sure you've already figured out. But next up would be the cinema releases, which again, we saw 14 movies at the cinema for the podcast, doesn't seem right at all. Because it feels like we've watched about one in the last like 5 months. We must have saw a lot in the first half and in particularly the middle of the year.
I was going to say, apart from Thanksgiving, like, what did we see?
We had Saw and Exorcist.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like post-Halloween. It's crazy.
Yeah, really not much. We had a lot earlier on. But yeah, so 14, but compared to last year, which was 26, however, that does include seeing 12 films at Fright Fest. So obviously, if you take that away, it's the exact same number of cinema releases that we saw. That's where obviously the big drop-off is. We didn't do Fright Fest this year. We covered 13 less films. We covered 12 films at Fright Fest, so it's basically one less if you don't want to include Fright Fest, which again is shocking to me because we have taken weeks off this year more so than ever before. So the fact that we were still that consistent does surprise me, and also the fact that I can't believe Fright Fest was only last year. It just feels like ages since we were there. It was only 2022. It feels like a very long time ago. Next up, the weird one, as always, which much like our awards, which we'll get to at the end, where we're just stubborn and we decide to never change them. Mm-hmm. One of the categories is Netflix films, which should really just be like, because we should have Shudder and all the different ones. But we only covered one Netflix film this year, which is kind of, again, surprising. I think it was that Bird Box, wasn't it? The sequel.
It's got to be our lowest ever for Netflix. I mean, other than TV,
Yeah, one. Like, it's crazy. We saw 3 last year, and it's usually between sort of 3 and 5 on Netflix. Very, very slow year for them for horror, for films. Next up is just the next, always the highest one, which is just all other digital platforms or Blu-rays or, you know, anything that's not Netflix or cinema, basically, which was 21 compared to 20 last year. So, again, pretty much the same. TV show specials was 4. Which again, exactly the same as last year, 4 TV specials. What did we do? We did obviously House of Usher, we did 2 on Black Mirror, and we did Creepshow. Pretty much consistent. And then the last one is just the amount of shows, which we did do 51 shows last year compared to 45. this year. So, yeah, that's where you can see that we obviously have missed a few weeks this year compared to our usually hitting around 50 shows.
Yeah, I mean, we're always round about the 50s, though. I mean, like, this has definitely been the year that we've been the most ill.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, most of December, we've been struggling. But even prior to that, there's been multiple weeks. Like, we very rarely in prior years have missed a show due to illness. We may have delayed it a little bit, but, like, there's been multiple shows where we've been wiped out for over a week and had to just delay the entire show.
Yeah, it's crazy the amount of times that we've both had to just not do it because we literally don't have a voice, or the amount of shows we did where like I just didn't have a voice for multiple weeks. I can't remember, was that last year, I think, where I had like a 3-month spell where I just didn't have a voice. That was fun. Yeah, so that's always good. And then yeah, lastly, the kind of specials, like anything that's not included in that, the only thing obviously included in this show, the best of, was our Wes Craven. So we did 5 of those last year and we did 4 this year. And obviously we finished it this year. So nice to finally get that finished after starting it in 2020. But yeah, that is it for the old statistics. Shall we go into our top 10?
Let's do it.
So yeah, obviously our big top 10 of the year of the films that we've covered. We do have a few honourable mentions. I don't know how many you would like to discuss, but there's definitely one that I would like to give a shout out to. A movie I really enjoyed, which was Missing. Obviously the kind of second movie, the follow-up to Searching. Big fan of these both films, really. Particularly this genre of screen life I'm always a big fan of. And I really do think that both of those films are some of the best we've seen in that subgenre so far. Really surprised. I remember seeing the trailer and I was like, this doesn't grab me at all. And then just sitting down and it just, there's so many fun twists and turns. Like, it was such a fun thrill ride of a film that may not have had the kind of the writing quality of the first film and just the overall strength, but it was just fun to see that many twists and turns in a screen life movie, because I think sometimes you are hampered by being stuck to a screen, and they did so many clever reinventions. So I have so much confidence that there's more in this genre, and I would love to see a third entry in this kind of franchise, as it were. So yeah, I was a big fan of Missing.
Missing was great.
Yeah. Any others you'd like to discuss?
Yeah, I mean, one that we saw recently, which was Hell House Origins, kind of. You know, I really think the Hell House franchise as a whole is just an incredibly strong modern day straight to digital franchise that Shudder has kind of mopped up and has continued to make really good entries. And this one, was this the fourth entry? I think was a really solid entry, had some really good scares, some really good just building of atmosphere. Like we said before, crazy building of the lore of Hell House as well, and kind of sets up like more sequels, which I would be down for. I think every one of these Hell House movies is strong, and this being the fourth entry, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say start here. I think, you know, you watch them all, but certainly you could watch this as a standalone and start for a really good time, and it was just a really good, fun movie.
Yeah, it was really cool. And, like, that's just a franchise that just continues to impress. That is one of those real standouts for Shudder, like we said at the time. They've just built such a great core group of IP now that I associate with Shudder. And Hell House is definitely one of them. Another movie I want to give a quick shout out to, because I remembered it, was Candyland. Because, again, not an amazing film, but what I really loved about this film, and it is actually one of the reasons why another film, which I just thought was better, did make our list, was just the vibe of it. It had such a cool vibe, like that place, that kind of truck stop with these group of characters, to me really felt like a lived-in place. And even though it wasn't particularly spectacular with its story, and when it got into like the actual characters and reveals and some of its religious tropes, it definitely lost me. But just like the vibe of that place, it felt so real to me.
It felt so real and so dirty, didn't it? I think Candyland is a movie that stuck with me more than most this year, you know, is just this feeling of uncomfortableness and dirtiness and, like you say, this location. And, you know, there are movies that are in our top 10 that I still have to, like, look up and go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I remember that now. Whereas Candyland, it's just vivid. Instantly you say the name and it's vivid. And I think that's the strongest kind of phrase I can give it, really.
Yeah, it has one of that, like, a tangible quality that it doesn't necessarily get represented well when you're doing a long form review, when you're discussing character and story and all that stuff. But it is just like the feeling. If it was something that I had watched not for the show and just walked away from it, I'd have been like, oh, I loved that. You know, that was a really cool vibe. So yeah, definitely deserving of a shout out for sure. And a very underrated movie as well.
Yeah, and I guess the only other one is Evil Dead Rise. Because I think that movie came out and kind of it is in a, you know, it's in a franchise that's just incredibly strong and near and dear to our hearts. You know, we love the Raimi trilogy, we love the remake, we love the TV show. So, you know, when this came out, it was like, okay, this is not as good as the others, and I feel like that's why it's kind of been forgotten about by us, but I still think it's a solid movie. And you know, if this was in a franchise that we didn't love as much, I feel like we'd probably love this movie more. Because ultimately it's definitely the worst Evil Dead movie, but it's still, like, you know, the worst Evil Dead movie is still better than a lot of other horror movies out there. And yeah, this still had some really good moments for sure.
Yes, Rise is such a weird one for me. Like, it's a movie that I wish I really liked. And I think on the face of it, there isn't many things inherently massively wrong with it. But, like, I don't, when I think about Evil Dead, which I adore, I think about four very different films and an amazing TV show. And then I go, oh yeah, there was another one. And it's just weird to me. I just don't know why. It just doesn't feel remotely like Evil Dead. Like, say, if this was a movie just called Rise, I would have enjoyed it a hell of a lot more. So it's a weird one for me. I'll maybe rewatch it at some point, but I'm certainly not in a rush to.
Yeah, I kind of want to.
Yeah, I think it's on UK Netflix. I could have sworn I saw it on there at some point.
Yeah, it's definitely somewhere.
Yeah, there's been some weird stuff. They got, like, Talk to Me, I think, really quickly as well. Like, so they've been pretty good in terms of getting, like, big horror films on there. But yeah, our top 10 starts. Do you want to kick us off with number 10?
Go for it. So yeah, this one kind of was one that we just watched a little bit on a whim, kind of, you know, had a little bit of excitement for it, but not much expectations. And it just kind of delivered on its promise more than anything. And that was Sick, you know, written by Kevin Williamson. That was kind of the main reason why we got in there. And kind of, the movie just opened, it told us what it was going to do, and then it just delivered on that. It just delivered on this really fun home invasion movie set kind of during the COVID pandemic. It had some really good tropes. It had some fun play I don't really like to use the whole kind of, like, fun play on COVID, because it still feels too real. Mm-hmm. But at this point, when we are this far removed from it, you know, you can kind of laugh at these tropes a little bit and the crazy world we're in. And having a home invasion movie set during, like, the pandemic is just perfect for me. you know, when you're not allowed to leave the house, you're not allowed to have people come and help you. And someone's come to your home to attack you. I think they did, you know, some really good scream kind of tension scenes. When we got to kind of the point that we had the kind of the hunters and the hunted kind of in the house, we still had some really good fun cat and mouse and backwards and forwards, because probably like 40 minutes into this movie, I thought it's dealt all its cards. It's kind of, you know, revealed what it's now all about, and how's it got another like 40 minutes 50 minutes left? But it really did deliver all the way to the end, and was a really fun movie.
Yeah, I really like Sick a lot. I remember being excited for it when we found it, being like, oh, Kevin Williamson wrote this COVID set slasher home invasion film that no one's talking about, and it's one of those ones that I always hoped it would be good. And I really like this film a lot. Again, it's really fun, which was the thing that really stuck with me. That middle part of the film that is just the cat and mouse chases was so strong. Like, I think that's the kind of thing that he writes so brilliantly and so flawlessly and so effortlessly, is just really fun on-screen cat and mouse between a killer and a victim. And his spatial awareness, he, you know, taken a singular location in a house and using every single part of that, you know, almost in like a Don't Breathe aspect, where you're seeing different areas, different rooms used in different ways. Then, okay, now we're going outside for a little bit. Oh, there's like this other little small area surrounding the house. Okay, now we're getting a car involved. Okay,
the lake.
Yeah, like, how do we eliminate the threat of the car now? Okay, that was a cool little game that kind of filled 10 minutes. Now we're back in the house again. Now we're grounded again. Like, it just did the fundamentals really, really well.
This one had one of my favorites, I think, as well, where the car's tires got slashed, but they still tried to drive it.
Yes, that, yeah, something we talk about all the time. Yeah,
and it didn't work.
Yeah, that was a eureka moment of like, oh, thank God, you know, it's that classic like scary movie, why do they run up the stairs and that? And it is that thing of like, why don't they do this? And they finally showed us that, which was brilliant. So it, again,
That's what would have happened to me in all these horror movies.
Yeah, like obviously he's just the best, I think, at that, of course, like his pedigree proves that. The COVID angle was a really interesting setup to get you in the film. And I think that ultimately it will be very Marmite how it's used in this film. Like, people are going to absolutely love it or hate it, I think, because it, particularly when you get to final act and character reveals and motivations and why COVID plays a part in that. Yeah, like, it's... I remember liking it at the time, but I also think if someone said it was, like, ridiculously cringy, I wouldn't be able to defend it. I'd be like, yeah, it is pretty cringy, but, like, I was in it.
Absolutely cringy, but it worked for me.
Yeah, like, yeah. I was just in it, and I'm not, I don't take these movies seriously. Like, I don't need a, I've never had, like, a Scream revelation at the end be like this, it stunned me to my very core how unbelievably realistic and grounded it was. You know, if it's just like, yeah, you fucked over my family, like, that's fine, as long as it's a cool character portraying it. So, like, that was enough for me. So, yeah, and
his, I remember, dad lost everything.
Yeah, and I remember the final kills as well, really, it not like saved it, because it wasn't a tragedy, but it was an awesome film. We had like some potentially cringe reveals, and it was like, okay, what do you do now? And I remember that last 10 minutes was like awesome. Like, it was such a cool way for the movie to conclude with the kind of final, you know, that's like a really hard thing to pull off. When, again, when you think about Scream, you always go back to that original film. Yeah. And how effective it was with the her getting the mask on and her calling the killers and all of these, and then Gail suddenly back and all that. Whereas I think all of the other Scream movies have failed to deliver that in terms of, you know, a really exciting post, you know who the killers are, what is that next big scene? And I think Six did a really... Four. Yeah, exactly.
Scream 4
and potentially another movie which we yet to discuss. But like Scream... Six, I think, did that. Like, I think it had a really fun payoff once the killers were unmasked, which I think is very rare in these types of films.
Definitely.
So, yeah, very worthy movie. And again, very underrated movie. I think there's a few movies in our top 10 which I think are very underrated. But next up is a franchise that we've talked about quite a lot, which was the latest entry in the VHS franchise, VHS 85. So yeah, kind of what, the third of these since it's come back. I think last year's one didn't make our top 10, but the other one did. And I think in my mind that feels right. This feels like a more of a return to form. Again, I liked last year's entry, but I think pound for pound this might have been the best one. Very difficult, because I genuinely think all three are good, you know, real great, you know, VHS films that have really good standouts segments and a couple of ones that miss. You know, this one had like the report quarter one that we necessarily didn't vibe with, but then it had like for the first
the one
time ever, yeah, that one was great, yeah. Where you had to learn Spanish. But the you know, finally doing it again, this is the sixth entry, and they did something that we didn't necessarily see coming, which was have two segments tied together in a really refreshing way. And they had a completely different vibe, and they delivered different things, but they connected storyline-wise. I think that was awesome. So that was really strong for me. And I thought that the overall 80s theme, the wraparound, was really cool. This was a great film, and I'm so happy they're continuing this. I think VHS has so much to give. It is one of, I think, the most dynamic franchises. Obviously, when you're dealing with something that is... of this nature where you can have different storylines each time, that helps. You don't have a canon, you're not tied to a legacy or anything like that. You just need to bring in cool filmmakers with great short ideas. And that's what they did here. Like that, you know, the first half, particularly that detective story with the kind of the dreams and the killing in the dreams. Like we talked about how that could have easily been a feature length film if they'd have kind of tightened up some of that stuff, because they definitely rushed all of the conclusions. But overall, man, I loved VHS. Like I need to go back and watch these because I don't think I've rewatched any of them, as is the way that we kind of keep moving. But I would love to. I think it's, I'm long overdue. Like I rewatched the original trilogy prior to this coming back, and I think I'm at a point now where I definitely want to rewatch these because I'm forgetting so many cool segments. But this was a great film.
I think that's the thing with it. It was just a really solid entry where it was a lot of fun segments. The double kind of feature was the standout for sure. I think there was one segment where they forgot to go fan footage altogether for about 5 minutes, which was
yeah, that was the dream one. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think like when we reviewed it, we said that like it just feels so VHS. It's so, you know, grimy and very, very kind of just raw, and so you kind of forgive it for all of these things because you don't want it to be this polished product. You want it to be this chaotic kind of 20-minute segment going into another chaotic 20-minute segment. I don't want, like, you know, this crazy fleshed out, you know, just smooth thing. I want it to be this way, and I think that's what it should be for this platform for filmmakers, just to say, yeah, just go mad and, like, you know, just give us a product, and it doesn't need to be crazy finished. It just needs to be, you know, VHS worthy, which shouldn't, you know, that's not like a negative. I think that should be a positive, that this just has its own, you know, barrier to kind of, you know, entry. And I really enjoy that. And yeah, I think this segment was, or sorry, this entry was really solid. I don't think it has like the incredible standouts like perhaps some of the previous entries, but I also don't think it has some of the lows as well.
Yeah.
You know, this one was more of just a baseline, fairly solid from what I remember of it. Even when I had to learn Spanish. So yeah, you know, I think, you know, a really solid movie and why it made it to our top 10.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, next up is a movie that, as soon as I saw the runtime for this, I thought, like, I'm not going to enjoy.
Yeah.
And going into it, like, we seen the trailer looked really good. And it was a case of, oh, okay, this looks like a really cool, like, revenge movie, kind of Taken-esque. This is God is a Bullet. And, yeah, kind of, that's what it kind of looked like from the trailer. And very early on, it just has its own visual style, you know, and character driven, and all the characters visually just have got such a distinct look. And I think kind of what we spoke about a lot was obviously Mika Monroe and her performance was standout in this movie. It was incredible, but also just the way she looked, you know, just so different to the way we've seen her before, just covered in these tattoos. And the way that kind of tattoo culture was kind of brought into this movie and kind of, you know, very prevalent with Bob. And it's funny because Bob kind of, the name just stands out to me. And when we reviewed it, it's because he's such a Bob.
It's all coming back to me now that you've said it. I'm like, oh, Bob, God.
Oh, Bob. Because he's the worst lead character in a movie in our top 10, probably. But he's meant to be. Yeah. And Bob. He is just going along for the ride and he's trying to just save his daughter. And it's Mika that is really kind of, you know, carrying the movie performance. Not like it wasn't a bad performance from him. He played Bob, you know, Bob. Yeah. Was Bob. Bob was there as to be a pacifist, to give Mika the opportunity to shine, which is exactly what happened. And, you know, this movie has some really dark turns, some really dark moments, some really over the top action, kind of John Wick style action sequences as well. And was just a really fun movie that probably was a bit too long, but ultimately, yeah, you know, for a movie to be that long and it didn't just drive me insane, just shows how strong this was. And I think it was visually how this movie looked and how the characters looked.
Yeah, for sure. For me, this movie, God is a Bullet, which is probably my favorite title for a film all year, was the movie I was referencing earlier, talking about Candyland, and how just the overall vibe I got from the film, when I think about it now, is so strong, and it's definitely stronger than probably when we reviewed it, because you have to talk about that runtime, which is crazy. And I think it shows how great the film is, because I think this could have been way higher. I think this movie at its best is way better than an eighth placed film. But its runtime and its certain subplots and certain missed opportunities, like I remember Jamie Foxx's character being a pretty big missed opportunity for me. Again, like visually he looked so cool and interesting, and he just didn't really add much to the party. But there is so much to love about this. Like I say, the overall vibe, the kind of dealing with this motorcycle gang meets religious cult, with all this tattoo stuff thrown in, was just such a cool, the setting and everything just worked for me. And I think
every minute version of this movie makes our top five.
I think easily, yeah, like, because the kills are phenomenal. Like I say, this has a great just visual style to the film. You watch the trailer and it looks cool. This is a cool ass looking film. And I think that it's filled with loud, extroverted characters aside from Bob, which is what's so interesting, that he is this kind of shy, inward feeling character that is super interesting, especially the actor, from Game of Thrones. I was really expecting more of a pow in your face kind of guy, especially because he does fulfill almost like a John Wick type character at times with the action, but he just never feels like that. He never feels like the big leading man, because he is the smallest character in the film. There are side villains that feel huge in terms of these big loud performances. That guy, the hilarious guy who's kind of in the nightclub and stuff, let alone like the main villain and Micah, who I think are two huge personalities, and kind of their relationship is what really drives the whole film. This kind of twisted, messed up relationship, and her getting away and then trying to save other girls from making the same mistakes that she did. Like, it's such a cool film, and I think her performance is what really elevated it. Said it on the review at the time, and I'll say it again, I think that she has been in better films. I think It Follows and Villains are overall better films, but it's her, my favorite performance she's ever given. I thought she was outstanding, and again, when you have a long runtime, that probably helps with that. You get to see more of her, so she can dive deeper into the character, have better, longer monologues, etc. But she's just outstanding. I mean, I've never seen her put in a bad performance, and I've seen her in bad films as well, and it gets me really excited for that It Follows sequel, because I think she's just grown so much as an actress.
Yeah, I forgot about that. It's gonna be so good. I think as well, this movie has an incredibly strong opening scene, kind of visually with the song and everything else, like with the kidnapping. I was like, man, this movie's got off to such a stronger start, more than I expected it to. And then it kind of cuts to the parents, or whoever, the people in kind of the house with the swimming pool and stuff, and the home invasion. And all of that stuff was really well done as well, and again had another really good soundtrack playing over the top of it. And I was like, holy shit, is this movie just gonna be like bang 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 bang? And then it did slow down and got going at a more even pace. But yeah, the opening was insane.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the soundtrack as well, because that reminds me now. Like, I love the soundtrack to this movie. Like, it was so cool. And again, it gave it such a distinct style. This is a movie that stands out. We saw a lot of films this year, and I still think about God is a Bullet, even though I think if I sat down and rewatched it, there'd be parts I remembered, certain subplots with characters and feeling that runtime. But now, just looking back on it, I only remember the positives, and there were so many. So yeah, I really, really liked this film a lot. But yeah, moving on to number seven, probably one of the biggest surprises for us, really. Pretty shocking that a possession movie can make a top 10 and be a considerably high place in number seven, which is Talk to Me. But I think it was so deserved. At this point, I think I genuinely hate this subgenre. Like, it's gone from like, oh yeah, I'm not really into it, to like, I think I actively hate it now.
I think you do.
Like, I hate what it's become. I hate that so much of horror is that. I hate that it's rewarded as well. Like, I think when you look at movies that we chose to not even cover this year, like The Nun 2 and stuff, that there's such a huge, like the casual audience for this stuff is monumental, and there's a reason why we're gonna see less of Last Night in Soho and more of The Nun 2, and like that just bums me out so much. There's like interesting ideas in horror, you know, even something like Malignant as well. Like, it's just it sucks. And so getting to something like Talk to Me, I'm actively against it. Like, I don't want to like it, and it was brilliant. It was such a breath of fresh air in a, like, say, a subgenre that I detest. And we saw, you know, one of the worst ones, I think, in Exorcist this year. And seeing Talk to Me come out this year of all years, I mean, it really was. It had to come out now. I was thinking about it where, you know, we were a lot softer on these. And I think when we were seeing stuff like The Conjuring 2, which is still by far my favorite of these films, so nothing compares to that. But I was just softer on it overall. And we were seeing more of the kind of the Conjuring spin-off movies and stuff like that. But I think Talk to Me had to come out now. It had to come out in an environment where we saw Insidious 5 or whatever it was, that shite film. And it needed to be a reaction to that. It's very self-aware, I think, that the subgenre is what it is in 2023. I don't think it's like ignorant to what's happening around it. I think it speaks to that and says, this is what the subgenre is. It can be something different. It's just that people aren't making original shit anymore. And so they're like, but it can happen. And so to bring it to a younger, more teen-focused audience, bringing in kind of social media trends, peer pressure, kids doing stupid shit all the time, I think it really just brings all that so well together. Like, the basic premise is ridiculous as well.
So
as like an old school, that feels like a Malignant style thing of just, yeah, it's fucking just hand.
You talk to the dead.
Yeah, and then it possesses you, and but you just do it as a funny drinking game to film you and put it on TikTok for the clicks and laugh about it. You know, nothing dangerous is ever going to happen. It's only a few dodgy spirits every now and again. Like, that works because that is today's society. Like, I fully believe that this is exactly how kids would react to this if this was a real thing.
Yeah, if this hand existed, 100%. What happened in this movie is how it would go down.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that's the thing that I loved about it, where, you know, throw in a stupid element of this hand, but then it feels so grounded because it's exactly what would happen, and it was just fun seeing it happen. It was almost as if, like, this is too high praise, but it's almost doing that what Scream did to the slasher genre, where it was so aware of the genre it was in and poked fun at it and then reinvented it, and it did it in a really fun way. I think the violence that was in this movie was it's weird saying, I mean, only in a horror podcast can you say the violence in this movie is welcome. but it was, and I think because so many possession movies shy away from gore and actual horror, and just it's all fart no poo, and I really like the fact that this movie did deliver and just went, oh no, we're gonna like the scene with the brother. Like, I was not expecting them to go that hard. It was crazy. And I think, like, the ending was a very hard ending as well. And, it was just a really solid movie. And I think, in terms of, like, a cinema, like, possession movie, like, making our list in 2023, like, it did incredibly well. It really did.
I still can't believe it. Like I say, we'd seen, I think, The Boogeyman and Insidious, like, prior to it in the couple of months before.
And we almost didn't see this because of that.
Yeah, and that was just the state of what it was. You know, that was exactly what I was expecting. Just these very sterile movies. You get a very boring setup, usually with, like, a horrific incident happens to a family member. And, you know, that's exactly what happened in both those awful films. And they're just full of dread and misery. And it's like, oh yeah, this character gets haunted for a bit and then they overcome it and that's it. And so for this to be so different, I remember being like, probably halfway through this film and thinking, I still don't know what the main structure of this is. Like, I get that it's this hand, you know, the basic premise from the trailer, but I don't know what this means for the story going forward. I don't know who it's going to affect the most. I don't know what's going to be the main thing they have to overcome. And so to get to the finale and it still be so kind of on edge, and again, having that feeling of, well, here's what the ending should be, but horror movies never have the good ending. They always pick the shit tap out ending, and they did the good ending. They were like, no, this is what would happen, and we stay true to it. And I think now that it did so well, when they're going to do a sequel, I really don't know what that entails. But as a standalone film, it just worked so well. And also, going back to the point I was making earlier about how it kind of really is such a good takedown or visualization of youth today, this being from two young directors who come from a social media background, these are obviously two Australian YouTubers who then decided to make a film, that's why this works. This is people that know that shit. You know, this isn't like jaded people in a room writing about a generation they don't understand. They're writing about themselves. And so that's why this movie works for me. Like, it's so genuine, everything about it. So yeah, Talk to Me is awesome. I really, really like this film.
Yeah, and I mean, up next, just narrowly missing out in our top five, at number six, we've got No One Will Save You. Talk about coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean this movie we hadn't spoken about until we recorded our show for it. It absolutely came out of nowhere and just had such a fantastic premise. It had a great kind of just tonally opening 20 minutes where we've got this lead character that you know, I think like she could be described as a mute. She's not a mute. She's isolated. She's just completely on her own in this big farmhouse. And even when she visits the town, she is isolated and we don't know why. No one talks to her. People avoid her. And kind of, I was so enamored by her and the town and what was going on. All of that stuff. And then suddenly we start to get to her starting to be invaded and having this home invasion at night. And I thought all of that was incredibly well done. And again, when you kind of, you know, how often do you watch a home invasion movie? And you're like, oh, I really wish it kind of speeds up a bit. And this just goes for it, doesn't it?
Yeah, this movie's crazy. Like, I couldn't believe how enjoyable this was as an alien film. Yeah. I think I don't... You really see alien films anyway, but then they try and be usually quite elevated. I think of a movie like Arrival that I love, but that's so talking about, like, what would really happen if you tried to talk about to this other race from a different planet and stuff, whereas this is way more just what would happen if it was a fun ride, that you were the only person in your town.
Yeah, and even, like, you know, really great horror movies, and you think, like, Alien and the sequels, like Prometheus, where it's like, we know what the fucking alien looks like at this point. Show us the alien. And it takes, like, an hour and a half to show it. Whereas, like, instantly, she gets invaded, and you see the alien. You're like...
Oh, it's so cool.
I'm like, you're being fucking invaded by an alien, love. And then like, the rules of the alien was great. Like, what can it do? Like, how violent is it? What abilities does it have? How do you kill it? And like, she kind of goes through that entire like chain almost in the first night.
Yeah.
But then the great thing about it is we then cut back to like her being shunned by the town and her not being able to get help. And I fucking love that. I love that she kind of escapes and gets to town and she's like, I'm more screwed here than I was at home, because at least at home I'm at home. And I love that so much. And I think pretty much from start, middle to end, this movie was great. I think it had a little bit of a slow moment in the kind of pre-finale kind of getting there. It took a little bit long, but then when it actually got to the finale, I thought the payoff was fantastic. The final images of the movie I absolutely loved, and yeah, I thought this was a stellar movie for sure.
Yeah, No One Will Save You just was such a delight. You know, this is the type of movie that I wish we had every week. That was comes out of nowhere, that has the kind of no long tail, no baggage, no anything. It's just an original IP that just delivers. You know, from the moment it started and we had that initial, again, cat and mouse back and forth between, you know, a single character and an alien. And you see the alien multiple times and they have this awesome back and forth, and then she kills the alien, and I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, how is this? That should have been, you know, especially talking about indie films,
that's like second act.
Let's be honest, that a lot of them you'd have 75 minutes of bullshit, and then the last 10 minutes would have been that, and you'd have said, well, that last 10 minutes was pretty cool. You know, but that the movie opens with that because it knows what it's got. I think that's, it's so confident in what it has. And so it's just almost like cocky, where it's like, yeah, we'll just give you something sick because we'll just wait. And you have no idea really what's coming. You know, I really thought that would have been enough for me. And so the fact that they keep adding new layers, you know, it almost felt like a video game where you keep getting more variations of the enemy. And okay, this one has a new trick, so how am I going to defeat that? And you having to adapt in the different situations. You can't just rely on the same trick. Like when she kills that first alien, you could think, oh, well, she knows how to kill an alien now, but that's not going to work the next time, you know. And it was very circumstantial to get that lucky as well, and that's what has to keep happening throughout the whole film for her to overcome.
Again, for like an indie movie, the fact that we got all these like subspecies of the alien as well was just insane.
Yeah, this movie is like so much better than it should be. Like, I think when you think about it, it's like, oh yeah, it's a small indie film and you know, it barely has any dialogue and it's about aliens. You're very much expecting a certain type of smaller contained film, and this is like almost like a Cloverfield. Like, it doesn't go that insane, but it just feels like something special. That they went so above and beyond in so many different aspects, and I was just blown away by it. I think it was really, really fun. This was like a short film as well that easily could have been longer, but I'm thankful that it was just the perfect length, which speaks to why it's high as it is. And this is another movie like the last one that the ending was fantastic. You know, like, I think that's really what gets movies on our top 10, is what completes a film, and then when you start pushing towards the top half of this list. And it's something that a lot of movies have in common, aside from maybe the next one, actually, which we'll get to. But I think they all have really good endings, and that, because that's what ties it together. It's that final feeling. I remember that the images that's on the screen when this ends and credits roll, I was just like dumbfounded. I was so smiling. I was smiling. I was like, you guys did it. I was just sitting there reading the credits, listening to the song, being like, you guys fucking nailed it. And that fills me with joy as a fan of these things, to be like, it sucks when you watch something that you love and they just miss that ending. You know, like, was it The Lighthouse? I think, no, not The Lighthouse. What was it called?
Lake House or
something like that. Yeah, the guy that did Hellraiser before Hellraiser.
Yeah, which was like, it was like a 8 or 9 out of 10, and then you couldn't stick the landing.
Yeah, and yeah, it, like, I still something like that. I still think about that because like it really bums me out, because so much of that movie was phenomenal, and then they just, I hated the ending so much, and it's such a shame. So it's so cool when you see a movie like this that just nails the ending. Big shout out to No One Will Save You. People need, again, this is, I think there's a few, especially this bottom half of our list. Yeah, we'll start to get into bigger films that people have definitely heard of. But you got to go and see these movies like Sick, like God Is a Bullet, like No One Will Save You if you haven't, because they're so good.
Can we talk about Baggage?
Yes, let's talk about Baggage, and let's talk about maybe not nailing the ending, actually. But surprisingly, still high on our list, number 5, which is Saw X. We finally did it. We get to see a Saw movie in a top 10 and a top 5.
It made a top 10. I mean, I'm just happy it made a top 10, let alone a top 5.
I know, like, I'm just happy that we made a Saw movie that I didn't hate, because what we've had to cover for the podcast anyway. You know, obviously we didn't, we were fortunate we didn't have to cover Saw 3D, which I think is probably still the worst, or certainly one of the worst, but let's not get into that discussion. But yeah, getting to Jigsaw and Spiral, it's been painful. It's been a long time coming to feel Saw.
Time listeners of the show know the pain that we've both been through, but you in particular.
We both felt it, and it's been rough. But I think this was you know, I consider this a win. Like I say, it has faults. We talked about them in our podcast. Particularly, I think there are some really unsatisfying conclusions, you know, particularly one character. And, you know, we talked about how they just greenlit a sequel, so they can rectify that. It doesn't make this movie any better or worse, but it just is what it is. But I think we saw amazing things. We got to see probably the best performance of Tobin Bell in the whole franchise, certainly one of the best, and it's amazing to go back to that. You know, I think Amanda, there's some weirdness in it in terms of it timeline wise, and it's incredibly fan servicey to put her in this film, but it worked for me. It was fun seeing her interact with John again on screen after all these years. I'm filled with nostalgia. This is a nostalgia hit. This is made for the fans, and again, is it some like remarkable original movie? Absolutely not. But did it finally cater to the fans? I said this going in, and I think I said it on the show. This is the 10th entry in a franchise. You're not making this for anyone else other than the fans. And if you are, you're doing it wrong. Like, the 10th entry in any franchise needs to be made for people that like the previous entries. If you're making a 10th entry thinking you're suddenly going to branch out and find a new audience, and yeah, the people that fucking hated the first 9 Saw movies, they're really going to love this one. Like, no, that's not what you're doing. Cater to that fan base. Cater to those original films and what made them so special for so many years, you know, those first 6 being so strong. So yeah, it was a joy. I'm just happy that we got to see Saw on the big screen feel like Saw. We got the music, we got the puppet, we got some really good traps, and we got great Jigsaw. So yeah, I had such a blast with Saw X. Like, it's just fun being a Saw fan, and I just took this. I remember leaving the cinema and not feeling dread and disappointment for the first time since the 6 film. So yeah, I will take this one as a win. I'm so happy with it.
I think that's the thing, like, when we you know, we've been on such a journey with Saw, and I think with like the Halloween remakes, where they were kind of like saying, you know what, like, fuck a lot of the franchise. We don't really like it, we're gonna make our own movie. And it's like, No, if you're making a 10th entry into a franchise, do it for the fans. And that's what they did with this. And, you know, was it the best Saw movie in the world? No. But did it deliver on fan service for the first time in a decade? Absolutely. And I think that's the thing where I'm like, you know, if this had been Saw 8, we'd have been over the moon. And the fact that, like, we've had so much dreadful movie, you know, dreadful experiences and ups in terms of a Saw movie being announced, and then multiple downs in terms of having to watch a new Saw movie. I think, you know, to finally see one that's not dreadful, we would have liked this movie more if we hadn't had the other stuff that preceded it. But in the end, this turned out to be a, you know, a strong, like I say, just a love letter to the franchise, where it's like, is it stupid? Yes. Is it, you know, is it ridiculous that everyone's aged 20 years, but it's set before a lot of the other stuff? Yeah, it's ridiculous. But it's like, I don't care. Do I want to see John Kramer? Do I want to see Amanda? Yes, I absolutely do. So I don't care how you give them to me, as long as you give them to me. And don't just, like, fake give them to me. Just give them to me. And that's what this movie did. Yeah, I think some of the traps, I think we did have some good traps. I think they did go a little bit too just like gory for the sake of being gory, as opposed to being clever. I would have liked there to have been some more clever traps, but the fact that we kind of had a group of people in a room, it kind of was just like, let's just pick one person and then just absolutely wreck them and then move on to the next. And that was enjoyable, but I would have liked there to have been, you know, more clever traps, but ultimately it was still a really fun movie. And, you know, hilarious that we're now talking Saw sequels in this little wheelhouse, this little window of all of these characters still being alive that we've managed to crowbar out, which is just insane.
Yeah, definitely. And before we move on as well, the last thing I have to say, and again, this is a minor spoiler for people, so be mindful of that. I'll give you a second. But they showed us Hoffman. Like, that is something that I was so happy. Like, I just, we never thought we'd get that. You know, it's something that we've talked about for ages. this kind of retconning and acting like he's not a huge part of why the franchise was so awesome. And yes, it was a slither with sprinkled throughout the whole movie, which was cool. But like, I just seeing him on screen, it's probably one of like my favorite 10 seconds of cinema all year. Because again, it's just pure fan service. And I get it if you want to get into that whole argument.
Yeah, we just never thought we'd get it.
No, like, I don't care about the context or anything, even though I actually liked the context. I liked the way his character was used in the film. But ultimately, I just needed Hoffman to get a reference. And for him to be seen on screen in that era with that world, I was just so happy, man, because it's something that I never thought we'd get. And so, yeah, going forward, obviously now, like, that has to be massive. Like, it can't just be a voice cameo and a one screen anymore, because, you know, that is... He has to be a substantial part. Yeah, he has to be a substantial part. He has to be on screen at least as much as Amanda was in Sorex. Otherwise, I'd consider it a disappointment. But yeah, have to give a shout out to that, because that is one of my small wins of the year of seeing Hoffman. Like, do you remember that feeling when it happened? I was just like, holy shit.
I was in shock.
Yeah, I still can't believe it. It's awesome.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, moving on, at number four, we have The Menu.
Mm, God, we saw that so long ago.
My God, so this was Disney Plus, right?
Yeah, Disney Plus, yeah.
And this was one that we kind of heard about a few weeks out and kind of saw the trailer for. The premise sounded cool and, like, went into it. I remember going into this, like, pretty excited. And this movie just absolutely delivered on what the promise was. You know, starring, it's got a great cast. We kind of have Ralph Fiennes, Anya Taylor-Joy, Nicholas Hoult, kind of basically this kind of insanely top-tier chef being played by Ralph Fiennes. To this, he only caters for, like, billionaires and the mega-rich, and we kind of go to this island, and Anya Taylor-Joy is kind of this... escort for Nicholas Hoult, and kind of this fish out of water that shouldn't be there. And then we just get to experience, like, this dining kind of experience for these people. And it's just it's the most over the top, hilarious, kind of self-aware thing I've ever seen in my life. Of these, it's exactly how I see, like, this top tier level of kind of cuisine where he's like, oh yeah, we're gonna have a bread course with no bread, we're just gonna have the sauce. And they're like, oh, it's genius, of course, have a bread course with no bread, what a genius. And I was like, oh man, I love it so much. And there was just so many points in the movie where we're not talking horror and we're not talking anything else other than just them poking fun at this, like, food world of this over-the-top, like, stupid, like, courses that make no sense and food that makes no sense. And, you know, the fact that kind of towards the end where, you know, Anya's character is like, just make me a fucking burger. Like, just make me a burger and chips. Like, that's what I want. It just kind of delivered on that so much. And then when we actually get into the kind of horror and the kind of story around it all, I think kind of Ralph Fiennes was incredible. I think kind of he just as the head chef just played it so well, and kind of had all of his understudies that would literally die for him. Kind of Nicholas Hoult's character was amazing, how infatuated with the chef he was. Mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, how that all played out was just immaculate. And again, was just a movie that to me, along with a couple others that we've just discussed, where it was just like start, middle and end, it just delivered. And when the movie ended, I was just happy with what it gave me, and was just like, yeah, you've nailed it. You've given me a really great movie. And yeah, I really loved it. I had some laughs. I loved the commentary on the food world. And then when we got the horror, I think it delivered as well.
Yeah, the Menu is such a fantastic film. Like, I desperately need to rewatch it because it's been, you know, nearly a year since we did. But it really ticks
super early.
Yeah, it was one of the first, if not the first show of this year. And so it was... just a great film. Like, I think you get such unbelievable performances. Like, that's definitely the thing that keeps with you, is those that trio of actors, and everyone really, like all the supporting cast, but like those three will anchor the movie, and it's so dynamic and interesting. I think Ralph as this villain is something that is so underutilized, his kind of villainous techniques. You know, he's dabbled in horror, he's very famously played a villain in Harry Potter, which I think is still very underrated. You know, he's working in a specific type of film that he obviously can't go as hard as he can here, but I think he still performs the shit out of that character in a way that
is terrifying.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, he brings that character to life way more than I ever felt Voldemort when I read the books. And so he is incredible. But to see so many levels to this character of why he is the way he is, I thought that was stunning, the way we kind of get all these reveals. You know, it's very difficult when you do that, when you set up someone to be interesting, and but it relies on character reveals, particularly in a final act. Your movie's gonna fail or succeed on that, and it just worked. Like, you get it, you go, oh, I get this guy now. He's not just this way because of whatever, he is this way for very specific reasons, and I love that. And the way Anya manipulates that in the finale is so strong. It really was a lot better than I thought, actually. Like, we were kind of, it came out in the cinema last year, and it was one of, like, is this horror enough? We didn't really know, and it was like, oh, we really like the people in it. You know, it had a forgettable trailer that was probably afraid to show too much, which I respect, and it shows you probably why it is hard, and maybe I am a bit harsh on trailers overall, because I don't like trailers that they show too much. But this probably was a case of, like, okay, they gave you what you wanted, and it was probably not enough to sell what the film was, because they didn't want to show you
the horror. That's the problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They didn't want to show you how unbelievably insane this is. This has a crazy body count. It has such a variety of kills, whether it's insanely emotional kills or zany over the top kills. Like, it really has everything. And I think also the actual, you know, you touched upon it, like the social commentary and the messaging, I think is really hard to pull off, because, you know, we don't focus on the negative ever in terms of our NDS stuff, but I do need to bring up this film because I think it makes a point about the menu. Like, this time last year, one of the movies we're most excited to see in 2023 was Infinity Pool, because of who directed it and who was in it. And I hated that film, not least because it felt like it had this really boring message of, like, yeah, the social elite, they're bad, aren't they? Rich people equals bad. And it didn't have anything else to add to that. It was just like, yeah, rich people are weird, aren't they? And I was like, yeah. Okay, I just wasted 2 hours of my life for you to tell me that rich people do weird shit and are annoying. Like, cool, I already knew that. So going into a movie like The Menu, I'm worried that they're just going to do that. They're just going to say, like, yeah, isn't high art and kind of fashion or any of these things, being really into Colony and the way he is, isn't that, you know, very annoying and stupid? But, like, it goes so much deeper than that. It really tries to analyze why people do this. I think that's the difference, is that it digs so much deeper as to, okay, but why do people do this? Because it's very easy just to say, yeah, the elite suck, but why do they want to do this stuff? You know, what's the motivation behind it? What's the real reasoning for wanting control and power and all these things? And why does it culminate in people wanting to waste literal millions on this very elite social club involving food?
I think what this movie has as well is a great supporting cast and characters within that supporting cast, where Infinity Pool is just like, okay, we're gonna have two or three really good actors, and then we're just gonna have a load of sucky rich people. Where it was like, oh no, this had, like, you know, it had the food critic, it had, like, the rich, like, lads, it had the couple that were going there that were, like, out of love, that never thanked the chef even though they went there like 20 times. Just all of these different, like, layers to it, that I think each one of those sub characters could have been a main character or a secondary character, but instead we had kind of eight secondary characters. And you know, I don't think there was a single dinner table that wasn't interesting. Yeah. And I think that's why this movie was so strong in the end.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Because again, that's another thing that you talk about I talked about the core of that trio of actors, and it would be so easy to be like, man, whenever you would think like whenever it's not Nicholas and Anya's characters interacting with Ralph's character, the movie would suck, and it absolutely doesn't. Like, everyone else fills their role, and you need a lot of characters in this movie because it's a horror movie and it wants to kill off people in cool and interesting ways. Therefore, you need to have people in it, and yeah, they're not just there to be killed. They all serve a purpose for different reasons. Like, there's a scene in the movie, isn't there, when he kind of prints all of these different things and character traits, and you talking about how there's like the couple who just do not appreciate it, you know, they take it completely for granted. For them, that is just like that you go into McDonald's, you know, they just happen to do this one special elite thing because they can, because they're privileged. This is such a cool movie. I really need to rewatch The Menu. I can't say enough good things about it, really. Moving on to our number three film. And this is, again, there's probably three films on here that I think, fill us with joy that they get to be on this list. And this one, it's 16 years in the making. And it is...
I'm just so happy it exists.
Yeah, like, I'm happy this exists. I'm happy we got to see it, and I'm happy it was awesome, which is Thanksgiving. You know, and again, I'm very happy that we finally got to cover an Eli Roth horror film. Not a horror adjacent, is it a thriller, is it this? No, he made a goddamn horror film. He finally made a slasher film, being that he's one of the biggest fans of slashers that have ever existed. And he made an incredible one. He made one of the best ones. And he made a super original one that I think will stand the test of time. I think hopefully it will become a franchise now. They're not going to milk it. They're going to take 2 years. I think that's the right call. But I'm excited. I think Eli has reignited his fire in his belly with the horror genre. And he has been for too long. You know, he's done films, great films, in the past, but I think he's back with a vengeance now, and this for me could be his thing that he's most, like, this late in his career, this might be the thing that we know him best for in 10 years. He might not be the Hostel guy. You know, we thought he would be that forever. He might be the Thanksgiving guy, because this is such a strong entry. It's fun, it's funny, the premise is awesome. I think it takes the wacky trailer and the way it substantially makes this into an original horror film in 2023 is almost mind-blowing. I don't think either of us saw that aspect coming. You know, we thought, oh yeah, it's a fun slasher, it's gonna have these wacky kills, you know, like people being cooked like turkeys, like we saw in the trailer and stuff. But to actually get like the use of modern tech, their take on Black Friday, especially in this kind of long, drawn out opening sequence, is not only hilarious, but one of the most kind of stressful, intense things I've seen all year. Again, nailing social commentary as well. And again, but it's not obvious. Like, that's there if you want to talk about consumerism and that being rampant and out of control. But fundamentally, it wants to just be a fun, entertaining, tense horror sequence, and that's what it delivered. Really fun characters throughout, a really iconic look and name of a villain who I think, you know, Carver is now up there with a lot of the modern ones that we've seen, almost like an Art the Clown, where we're starting to see these more traditional archetypes of horror icons come back, and I'm here for it. I want to see the next generation of Freddy and Jason and Pinhead and Leatherface. It's so cool.
Icons are why I love horror.
And
it felt like the genre for so long shied away from having like a vocal point and being like, oh yeah, we're going to give you a ghost face, we're going to give you a Freddy. And it's like, yeah, give us, you know, don't just give us a slasher movie, give us an icon as well with it. And you know, Art the Clown did that fantastically in recent years. And you know, I think, as you said, this has done the...
It really has, hasn't it? Like, I think it's... Carver really will stand the test of time, and I can't believe that this worked out. I think that's kind of like my final point, and I'll throw over to you, is like, it really... I, as a fan, as a, someone who is probably more than a fan, like, it's arguably my favorite film experience ever in terms of everything that encompasses Grindhouse, from being obsessed with Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez at the time, you know, loving both those films, and is still two of my favorite films. But then my obsession with these weird fake trailers, what's Rob Zombie doing? What, you know, what's Edgar Wright doing? Oh my God, Machete has now become two awesome films that I love. And to finally... to finally see Eli join that and add to that legacy. I thought it was over. I thought that time and a place was gone. I didn't think we'd still be seeing new stuff, but it hasn't, though. That's the thing. Like, these are, you know, we're now in a post Thanksgiving world. We're gonna get Thanksgiving too. Grindhouse is an ongoing
on Rob Zombie.
Exactly. Like, we need, you know, what's Edgar Wright doing? What's Rob Zombie doing? They're the only two now. Come on, guys, you're dropping the ball.
I don't know whether Edgar Wright has got that sort of risk in him right now, you know, unfortunately. I wish he did.
I get so worried, but, you know, as a fan of him, because I don't know what he does next.
He made his most beautiful movie and no one saw it.
It's going to be shit in terms of for us. I think he's going to make something that is
Transformers or something.
Yeah, it'll be Transformers, or it'll be like a, you know, a, yeah, or Batgirl or something. It'll just be some rubbish franchise film that we just don't care about.
Yeah. But anyway,
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. This movie is just obscene, really, because it for us more than most people, because, you know, 90% of people that see this movie is going to have no idea. Which is fantastic, but the fact that, you know, this trailer existed, this movie, you know, the trailer was fun back in the day. It was a really fun over the top trailer that made no sense, and you can't make a movie from that trailer, because it's just you can, but it would just be a very simple movie. And and kind of when this got announced, I thought, oh, okay, Eli's just going to go for it, and he's going to give us a really simple movie. We're just going to go hit those kills and just be really dumb. And it's going to be a really throwback to like an 80s horror movie where it's just simple and dumb. And then the movie starts and we get this Black Friday and this whole scene around Black Friday. And I was like, he's fucking made a script. I'm like, he's fucking made a film out of this. And then we got further into it and I was like, he's made a fucking franchise. I was like, what a crazy son of a bitch. And that's what blew me away, that this movie, you know, needed to exist. Once it got announced, it needed to exist for the fans of the trailer. Because ultimately, if it's not doing that, it's like what we said about Saw, it's failing. but the fact that he went above and beyond and made this awesome movie, you know, it had fantastic kills inside and outside of the trailer. I think it should have had more towards the end. I think the end was a little bit long in the tooth. But I loved the opening. I loved a lot of the cat and mouse. And then ultimately it won it back around in the finale. It was just a really solid movie that had no right to really exist in 2023. You know, a movie made from a trailer from, 16 years ago, or whatever it was. It's like, it's absolutely preposterous, and I love it. For that reason, like, I will be forever happy that Thanksgiving exists, let alone the fact that we're going to have sequels.
Yeah. And we finally got Eli in the top 10. Like, I think it's so cool. Yeah. You know, we've got to celebrate so many of our favorite directors. We've grown to love new directors that obviously the likes of Eggers and stuff weren't loves that we brought to the podcast before we started it. You know, we've had people like Rob in the top 10 and stuff and Edgar, but to see Eli finally be here, you know, he's such a huge name in the horror genre, and it really has been a shame that we've not got to discuss three or four of his films at this point, and so I'm just thankful that we got this one.
I think that's the thing, like, Rob Zombie and Eli Roth were like those like horror guys that we loved, that kind of reignited the fire for us that was the genesis of the podcast starting. It was like, oh shit, there is still good new horror, and there are new guys, you know, we don't just have to love Wes Craven. And so the fact that we finally get one was great. But I guess we're going to have to move on, unfortunately. but yeah, number two, this movie was one that I remember when I discussed it in my upcoming list, and was just like really excited about it because of the premise, and then the fact that it was British, and just sounded like very over the top, and just had this. I remember them watching the trailer and being like, "Oh man, this looks like better than what I thought it should be," and then the movie just never came out. And eventually we got to see it this year, and that is Unwelcome. And yeah, the movie has again, like we've spoken about it with a few of the movies in our top 10, this movie has a really strong opening scene. Very dark and very you know, we meet the couple with kind of expecting their first child and literally just getting the positive test, isn't it, in the opening scene?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then suddenly they get attacked by a gang, and just this sense of like, oh God, please don't hurt her. Like, please don't hurt her. There's no need to hurt her. And then eventually when it happens, and you just think like, oh God, this whole movie is now going to be like dread of this lost child. And I remember then when it like cuts to them like traveling to Ireland, and you don't see her fully for a little bit, and then eventually when you do and you see that she's heavily pregnant, and it's just like this sense of relief where you're like, oh thank God. Like, it was great to have that for like an opening scene of the movie. and then eventually when we actually get to kind of the couple kind of moving to Ireland from, you know, London, and kind of being these fish out of waters inheriting this house. And the fact that when they get shown around and the lady that shows them around, just kind of, it's such an amazing scene where she's just showing them around and she's like, yeah, so, you know, you got four bedrooms, you got like a kitchen, you got an outhouse there, you got a nice big garden. Oh, and that gate at the bottom of the garden, you have to kind of put raw meat there and feed the goblins every night, otherwise they'll kill people. So, and it's got beautiful views of the town if you go up to the top. And it was like, I loved it so much.
Yeah, it was beautifully written.
It was so beautiful. And then when we eventually kind of get into it, all of the lore with the goblins is great, but it doesn't take over. The movie is still about this couple. This couple trying to renovate their house and employing the best family of builders that have ever been in a movie. I think just the best representation of like low end local British builders that I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Every scene that the family was in was fantastic. What were they? The Whelans. Mm. And you know, let alone when Daddy turns up and makes everyone call him Daddy, was just, there was so many parts of it was fantastic. Let alone, you know, already glossed over the scene where they we get a typical British pub, and we get that played to perfection, which is one of our favorite things in a horror movie. Yeah, although this movie was set in Ireland, it felt very local, kind of for us, and kind of, you know, a lot of the scenes and the scenery and the where this was set, it just felt very, very very local to us, and very kind of, you know, true to what we wanted a British horror movie to be. We've spoke about it for years, of this kind of small desolate towns with this, you know, the overgrown. The fact that this movie actually has a narrow road with a close encounter with a tractor is fantastic. and yeah, just so many things like that that it delivered on. It had laughs, it had scares, and some over the top kind of characters and villains as well. And the whole goblins, the fact that kind of when they eventually kind of appear on screen, they deliver so hard, you know, that it could have been in the shadows, never shown. It could have been just played for laughs. And in the end, it was dark and hilarious and just very well done, I think, anyway.
Yeah, Unwelcome is a remarkable film. I still can't believe that all of those different elements work as well as they do. Because, yeah, you normally get one or the other. But, like, the fact that it starts and within the first 10 minutes, I'm so emotionally invested in the characters was outstanding. We then, like I say, get all of these... You know, it's almost like they've listened to what we've wanted in a film for the last 5-6 years and just put them everything in. It was like, do you want this hilarious tour guest that's setting up this horror trope? Has this amazing take on a pub scene that's very kind of self-aware? Just outstanding. So the fact that it delivered the setting, the tone, all of that stuff, you then get like the wheel and stuff is... It's rare that when I hear someone talk about it or I just think about it, I'm laughing to myself because it's like unbelievable how funny these sequences are. Like, it's by far the most I've laughed at anything all year was watching this goddamn family interact with this poor couple and being, you know, like, I'm laughing because I just know that situation and have seen it time and time again, and it's such an amazing portrayal of it. You're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. Like, there is no right answer, you know, because you have a problem that needs to be fixed, and they are the only people you can rely on. You've got
a literal hole in your roof.
Exactly, and so you're just going to have to let him take a massive shit in your toilet. It's as simple as that, and so and eat all your biscuits.
He's going to have to eat your biscuits. Yeah,
so it's just outrageously done. Like, this is someone who has also clearly lived this life to put this in this movie so flawlessly. It's clearly based upon, like, real interactions, and it just works. So, like, all of that works, and then it goes, oh, but how about a major portion of this movie is this incredible dedication and throwback to an era of horror that you just don't see anymore? The level of creativity and puppetry with these kind of physical creatures, and making them come to life, having personalities, having all different fun ways to interact on screen, having cool, fun ways to kill people on screen, where it really is these gory, over-the-top violent kills that are ludicrous because it's that leprechaun energy, it's that troll energy. It just works. Like, I really cannot believe that it does those things. I really thought it would either be in one column or another column. Oh, this was so dumb and fun, or has our more serious horrors, our more elevated horrors. And I think this has done the best job of merging those two. It has laugh out loud scenes, but it has real scenes of and it's not just the opening scene as well. I think their fears of trying to raise a child in this world is like a really awesome theme that carries the whole movie. And I think the main female performance, her kind of like maternal instincts, is what is really strong throughout the whole movie. Like, I just loved it. It's Unwelcome is an outstanding British film, and we've got to see so many incredible ones, and and they also different as well. When you think about what Saint Maud does compared to what this does, they're like so different films, but I love them both so much. And so I adore Unwelcome.
We've got to see such standout British horror movies that have just filled us with so much joy. The fact that, you know, we've got to see them, and it is one that, like, we're always going to champion British horror movies more, but the fact that we've got such good ones, it's made it easier for us, which is great.
Yeah, and like I said, I think before there was an era that was very much like almost like a slapstick comedy horror is what you got mostly with British films, and I think we've come so far past that now with movies like Saint Maud and obviously Last Night in Soho that are just best in class across the genre. But then something like this that feels, yes, it's funny, but it's not funny like those movies 15 or 20 years ago were, those British horror films. I think they were probably in the shadows of the Hammer and stuff, and I think we were trying to find our identity for a while, and I think they've truly found it now. They found their niche, like what we kept talking about, is that there are these pockets, these small communities, and that's always what makes horror so great, is finding these small towns, and Britain has so many of those, of these weird little things. And like I say, this feels like, yeah, we just stumbled into this tiny populated village in Ireland, and everyone's normal and everyone's happy, except for the fact that there's these little goblins that come out at night, and you just leave your raw meat out and everything will be fine. And to be honest, in this crazy, crazy world, especially given the two opportunities, would I rather live in a shithole in London or this place in Ireland? It would be a no-brainer for me. I know which one I'd take in a heartbeat.
You just feed the goblins, you know, it's not that bad.
It's not even close.
I think as well, like you say, I think in some ways, I feel like Shaun of the Dead was such a problem for British horror for a while, because people looked at it in the wrong way with Shaun of the Dead and then Hot Fuzz, and they looked at the comedy so much of those. But actually, if they looked at Hot Fuzz and what it did for, like you say, small town British culture, and kind of showing that and bringing that into the horror movies. And I feel like for probably a decade, we had movies like The Cottage with Andy Serkis, which was a really fun, you know, funny horror movie, had some good kills, and was a really good British horror movie, but was very much along the DNA of Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
And it was the best one, I think, post Shaun of the Dead that we got. But, you know, and it's taken so long to branch away and be like, no, you know, St. Maud has got zero laughs, but it has, you know, the DNA of Hot Fuzz with this small town, you know, give us that vibe and show us what these tiny communities are like, and not being afraid to be British in a horror movie, which is what Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz did, where it's like, oh, if you want to like it, rest of the world, like it, but it's going to be very British. We're going to joke about cornettos, and we're going to, you know, we're going to do things that are very British. And I think, you know, those are the things that movies like St. Maud and Unwelcome have championed, those parts of the Edgar Wright movies, as opposed to the comedic parts, which is long overdue for sure.
Yeah, I wonder how this movie reads outside the UK, because I do feel like there are certain characters, especially with the Whelans and that either
the Whelans,
you know, either the style of comedy just doesn't work because you can't relate to that type of person, or just the accents are so strong. You know, I'm even not picking up every single word that they're saying, because the delivery is so quick and heavy with that accent that I wonder if that is a point of contention for other people. But yeah, such a great film. I'm really disappointed that this doesn't have like an amazing physical release, because this for me is one of those movies I want to own. I want to champion.
Arrow.
I would obviously love any of these amazing ones to do like an amazing treatment. But like, I looked into it and I couldn't even see like a decent just physical UK Blu-ray. There's an American release, and there's like a Spanish release, which obviously it would just be the text on the cover or whatever. But like, it's weird to me that this is a British film that seemingly doesn't have a proper release over here. I looked on Amazon and other major websites and couldn't find one, so I don't know what's up with that. And it's a shame, because I should just say, oh, it doesn't really matter and I'll just rent it digitally. But like, that's the only reason why I haven't rewatched this film, is because every time I think about it, I look into buying a cool version and then it just doesn't exist, and then I just forget
what we do.
So yeah, they need to sort that out. But yeah, Unwelcome's an incredible film. But it sadly takes the run-up spot, but I think it'll be very happy with that. It's such an underrated film. And again, that's another one that people need to not sleep on, Unwelcome, because I feel like it didn't even remotely get the coverage it deserves. And it is strange.
Mine.
Like, we'll probably get to this more in a sec, but I guess I'll say it now, but it's on my mind, is like, there are so many films I saw that did kind of take over the internet for a little while, and a couple that we covered that were terrible. They were just absolute shite.
Even ones that were like okay,
Megan
was like 4 months.
At least I get that though. Like, I get with the marketing and with the trailer and who made it. Like, to me, that made perfect sense that Megan got a lot of coverage. But there's other films that we saw that was just like that found footage one in the desert. I can't remember what it was called, but like, everyone was raving about that to the point where I was like, oh my god, is this like the new Blair Witch? And that movie was awful. And I was like,
that movie. I honestly thought you made a movie.
Yeah, like, yeah, I'm not sure that.
Because I thought Matt's trolling me.
Yeah.
Like, this is a troll. Like,
was that the one?
You were so excited.
I think that was the one, wasn't it? Where I literally had to I pulled up the reviews afterwards, which I've never done in 8 years of doing the show. Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Because I had the quotes of all what people had said about it. Because it was like, it made no sense. I was like, I did not.
I was like, I remember I was just like sending you a string of messages whilst watching it. Like, you got to be kidding me, right? Like,
yeah, so I was like, I'm not taking the flack for this. This is genuinely the entire horror community online's fault. And I say, no one's talking about a movie like Unwelcome. But anyway, we'll leave that because, yeah, we need to talk about our number one movie.
Like number one, baby.
Yeah, the number one movie of the year for us. I mean, it's probably no surprise. Like, if people have heard us talk at any point in this year,
the last 6 years.
Yeah, like, I don't think it's a surprise because we love this film and we obviously love this franchise, but I think both of us are blown away that it ended up being our number one film, which is the latest entry in the Scream franchise, of course, Scream 6, which even this film, yeah, seems like a long time ago now. So much has happened post-Scream 6 that it's like, oh yeah, that film came out, but like, it's easy to forget that because this movie, I was blown away. You know, we talked about Scream 5 last year. It was number 10, I believe, in our list. And, you know, really liked it. And it was really cool how much they stayed true to Wes. I think they were almost overly respectful at times, which is so, so cool that they did that. You know, they didn't want to step on the toes and they wanted to treat Legacy right and this and that. But I think this was, we talked about this time last year. They said about taking the shackles off, we've got our new characters now that we believe in and we want to go for it. And that's exactly what they did. And they just over-delivered. I really didn't think a direct sequel to last year's movie could be this good. Really liked those characters in the last film, but I fell in love with them in Scream 6. The core four is iconic to me in horror, is the reason why we both agree that going forward, and again to ignore the, you know, the what actually happened, the bullshit, but from a fan perspective, we both said like we are done with Legacy. We don't want to see Legacy. We want to see the core four in another film. That's how much we love them, and that's rare. I think we said again, like, what other horror franchise has kind of done that? Has stayed good always and completely reinvented itself to like a different thing. Like, when I think about why we love Scream now, I think about Wes Craven's movies with Kevin Williamson and that core cast, and then I think about the two movies with the core four now, with these new filmmakers. And it almost is like two eras. Yes, there is that crossover, there is that reference in Legacy, we've got certain links to characters from the past films, etc. But it does feel like it was the respectful way to bring Scream into the modern age, to modernize Scream. And it wasn't just, it could, again, you've already referenced it once, so I don't even want to beat it again, but it doesn't need to be one of these franchises that just relies on, hey, do you remember that character from the 80s that you love? They're back now, and that's it. They don't add anything new to the party, and it could have easily been that. It could have easily been, you love Dewey, you love Gale, you love Sydney. It could have been so easy to rely on those characters again, and I'm sure they could have made a very successful couple of films and potentially a new trilogy just based upon those legacy. But they didn't do that. They made new, bold decisions. You know, in this new movie, I think they make the killer reveal from the last movie even better, which I think is a great retcon, because that was my biggest issue with Scream 5, and I think now it's less of an issue. I still think this movie's infinitely better and is just such a strong film overall. The kind of that huge sequence that we talk about a lot in the middle, involving so many different moving parts. You have like a character who gets killed in a bedroom. You have a guy watching who can see that happen, who's trying to contact the other members. You know, you then have the cat and mouse scene with some people run down the stairs and leave. You have other people trapped in a bedroom who's trying to get to the guy across the street involving a ladder. Like, the way that entire thing evolves and has different threats, has, you know, your mind start racing about, well, who's really in on this? Because you really see like almost everyone in this scene, which I think is so rare in a Scream film. That's almost like the one trick that they have to pull, is that, okay, each character is going to have their confrontation with Ghostface almost separately, or you'll have like a duo. So it's really rare to see pretty much everyone in one scene. And like, the way they get around that is very clever, I thought. and the way the killers are revealed as well. Like I immediately rewatched this movie and I think there's so many cool throwaway lines or were throwaway lines the first time I watched the movie. Now knowing who the killers are, it makes perfect sense. It's very knowing. It's very meta. I think they're there for people that are rewatching the film. You know, the opening sequence is something that was, a breath of fresh air for us. You know, again, it is this very specific to us, but like we called it and it's something that we've actively, you know, the receipts are there. You can go back and listen to us talk about five Scream movies, and during the course of that we will have absolutely talked multiple times about how we've always said we either want the killer to be killed in the opening scene and it be the reveal that it was just a copycat, or, you know, the person gets killed who's being stalked. And we kind of got both of those things, you know, slightly remixed and in slightly different ways that I didn't see coming as well, particularly with what happened to that first killer. It was just outstanding. This was a joy. What would you like to say about this incredible entry in the franchise?
Yeah, I mean, it just like you said, it built on what was a really good you know, continuation post Wes and post Kevin in last year's entry, but had no right to be as good as what it was. And I think not being afraid to take those shackles off and just run with the new characters was such a bold choice. And one that ultimately delivered. We had some really great kills in this movie. We had some really great sequences. You know, the opening scene was fantastic. The apartment ladder sequence was out of this world. The fact that seeing the trailer and seeing the subway sequence,
yeah,
and we were like, oh, we know how this one plays out. And then it played out totally differently in the movie. It was just so clever, and just so many parts of it really was clever. Yeah, to the point that I'm absolutely in love with Scream still, and just because I never was out of love with Scream, but I was always worried that the love could end very quickly. But I'm so happy with the movies we've had, and you know, worried about the future because of all the bad news that have come out post this movie. But where they left the franchise at the end of this was at such a great spot, really. And to me, it almost feels like now, knowing what we know, it would be better to move away from these. And that this could be a goodbye for a lot of these characters as opposed to a continuation.
Mm.
You know, when Sam kind of drops the mask and everything, that could be her just saying, fuck you, Billy, I'm walking away. And it didn't feel like that when the movie ended. But now, knowing what we know, I kind of, you know, hope that is what it is. And yeah, you know, like you said, the fact that this makes the killer from the last movie better. Yeah, was really great as well. You know, the legacy characters that came back were the worst parts of this movie for sure. You know, Gale and Kirby. But we're still fine, you know, but it proves that Scream is more than legacy. And I think that's the most important part. If we were in like this movie and we still just had those three characters still alive from the first four movies, you know, it would have just become so difficult to continue watching them. Even though I love those characters more than almost any character in horror, that they can't keep surviving and being in movies. And that is true for the core four as well. You know, did I think that it would just be two movies? Not necessarily, but I don't want to see him for like four or five more movies. Do you know what I mean? You know, they need to die or move on. And if all of the news that we've got coming out means that they move on with a new group of characters, I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's where, I mean, that was where we kind of disagreed, or the only thing we disagreed at the time was that I was very much like, I think this is peak Scream, and I don't see how you could get better than this. That was the only reason why I didn't want more. Whereas obviously for you, it was fair enough that you were like, well, this movie's awesome, let's make another one. I think obviously now things are very different. I don't think, you know, that forcing a trilogy, yes, it makes a lot of sense storyline wise a lot of the time. You know, there's a reason why trilogies exist and are so consistent. But I also really like what you said of, you introduce the characters and you like them. I think we then got the best version of these four characters. And I am more than happy to walk away right now with these four. I don't think it would have been, you know, there are definitely loose ends like her mom, etc., who have not played a part yet, who could. And again, that's ignoring the real life stuff that we know, because if it is the case that we've now got two of our core four, especially the main two, the Carpenter sisters not being a part of Scream 7, it's just pointless to me. And like the talks of bringing back Nev and stuff, I don't want that to sully this, because it's very easy to then be like, oh, well, it was all just shit anyway, and blah, blah, blah. Because ultimately, all of this stuff happened after we saw Scream 6. And Scream 6 is an incredible movie. I think it just shows this franchise as well. If we talked about it before, that it's one of the most overall strong horror franchises that have ever existed. And it's potentially the strongest, because if you ignore the TV offshoot, and how much you want to kind of include that, you have six films that I think are all great. I think that's the thing. I think a lot of people do. So it's, you know, it's whether or not you want to include that, because whilst I enjoyed the first two seasons, that third season was one of the worst things I've ever seen. But I also don't think it really counts. Like, maybe that's me just making up excuses for something that I love, but to me that doesn't feel like Chucky or Evil Dead, you know, because fundamentally it wasn't any of the original people anyway. And I know you could argue that's the same with these two, but you know, you didn't have cast members either, so if you don't have crew or cast working on it, what really is it other than just selling the rights? So I think if you look at just the film franchise, it is so unbelievably strong. You know, because I think last year's entry is my least favorite. And I love Scream 5 is awesome. I really liked it, and I think Scream 6 has made it better, and it's my least favorite Scream. And Scream 6 is just, it elevated everything, and I think it had such a strong finale, again, compared to last year's entry. The idea of the shrine with kind of bringing back all the killers and stuff, again, good amount of fan service, but not hitting you over the head with it. Letting the new characters do the talking. I think some of the more stuff like the Billy stuff in last year's movie, and we talked about going into this one how nervous we were, you know, how I had kind of sketched out like, oh, here's my take on what could be the worst version of Scream 6 involving our lead character. And they almost did it as like the whole movie's trolling, they're gonna do that, and then they say, of course we're not gonna do that, that's stupid. And that's brilliant. Like, I love, like, what you talked about with her throwing that mask away and leaving that aspect of her behind. Like, no, she's not just going to become the psycho killer because of who's, what her blood is. Like, they really nailed that, I think. So yeah, Scream 6 was a joy. I still can't believe it was as good as it is. And I still can't believe a franchise movie wins our best movie for the first time.
I know, it blows my mind. Like, you know, if you'd have said to me at the beginning of the year that our number one movie of the year is a Scream movie, it would have filled me with so much joy.
After last year as well, when it was number 10.
I know. Well, and we were happy.
Yeah.
I remember in our top 10, we were like, we're glad that Scream is one of the best movies of the year. Yeah. But, you know, Scream multiple years would have been our movie of the year if we were recording a podcast back then. So the fact that we got it and this was the movie of the year, you know, was this the strongest year for horror? No, absolutely not. But Scream was still the best movie of the year, and that makes me very, very happy.
Yeah, for sure. I think we can kind of transition that into that now, really, as we kind of sum up before we go into our individual awards. 2023, it's interesting because we talked about on a week by week basis that I think it wasn't as strong as previous years, and I think that is the case. I think it's also it was twofold for me personally. I think film outside of horror was also very weak, so yeah. Therefore it kind of dragged horror and just film down in general, because aside from Oppenheimer and Mission Impossible, there's like almost no other film I really enjoyed this year, you know, that wasn't a horror film. And that's rare. Usually there's like so many. Well, I did like The Creator as well, but like there just wasn't a huge amount. And then the fact that TV and video games over delivered massively this year, and had their best years almost ever, you know, across the board for both. And so that was like, oh, that's also then brings film down, because I prefer film usually more than anything else. Yeah, I had way more fun with certain TV shows and certain video games. So just, it was a weak year. But then I look at the top 10 and I really like these films, of course. I think for me, what stands out is they're all really good. Like, this is a great list that I would recommend people watch all these films. But you look back on previous years and it's absolutely missing a Lighthouse, a Midsummer, a Last Night in Soho, you know, like these really, The Northman last year, like these big films that I think were, and maybe that's just shows how lucky we've been with Get Out and Don't Breathe and A Quiet Place. Like, to me, they are modern classics that I will, you know, I'll forever cherish, you know, Soho and these movies. They genuinely are some of my favorite movies ever. And this year absolutely doesn't have that. It has an amazing franchise movie and it has a bunch of really great films. But like, I don't think I'll look back on any of these. Summer, Get Out, A Quiet Place. I just won't, because it was lacking particularly original horror on that really elite level. But it was good. It was consistently fun. But yeah, overall, I think like certain heavy hitters missed for us that aren't on this list, and then we just lacked a lot. You know, we had Flanagan doing TV, which is why TV was so strong. Yeah, but we didn't have the big names that we've had previously. And the big names that we did have didn't deliver this year. We had M. Night, who didn't deliver for us. We had Brandon Cronenberg, who didn't deliver for us. Like, there was big names. There was some other ones as well. But, like, it's just, yeah, it's interesting. What do you think about it, I guess, kind of overall and compared to other mediums, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I think this year has been really difficult. You know, there's been, you know, when you did your recap and show how many episodes we did and how many new movies we did, you know, yes, we've had illness as evidence, with still suffering with it, but we've also, you know, it's been easy to take weeks off because it has been a struggle. You know, that there have been multiple weeks where we've had nothing to watch and we're literally like just searching for stuff, and when these gems have come up, it's made them all more rewarding. But I think this has been one of the weakest years that we've ever covered for the podcast, for sure.
Yeah, it is. I think when, aside from 2020, which obviously had its reasoning, I do think, yeah, because we've really come back with a vengeance post that. I was very worried what the long-term effects of COVID would have. And 2021 and 2022 were so unbelievably stunning. And maybe that is, we're now catching up of like a three-year cycle. And we're starting to see certain gaps. And also, maybe it's just the way it fell. Because if you look at next year, it's crazy. When you look at the names that we're getting next year, we're getting Robert Eggers. We're getting a Mike Flanagan movie. We're getting a Jordan Peele movie. You know, we're getting Saw. We're getting a lot of big stuff. And so maybe it was just a case of, yeah, a lot of people just didn't... They just weren't ready this year. And so this is what we got. But yeah, it certainly wouldn't go pound for pound with a lot of our other lists, for sure. I think the first year in 2016, we kind of didn't have as a comprehensive cover of the genre. You know, we kind of really started full time every single week in 2017. And then aside from obviously 2020, I think this probably is the weakest year. Yeah. But still some good films though, like you're saying. And if you only watch film and only watch horror film, it would have been a struggle. If you like all forms of entertainment, especially TV and especially not just video games, horror video games, this year had arguably one of the greatest years ever for horror video games, with the Resident Evil 4 remake, the Dead Space remake, and Alan Wake 2. Like, those three alone are ridiculous. Like, that's an insane year to have free, like, elite level horror video games, which is fantastic. But yeah, shall we take a quick break and we'll move on to our individual awards.
Let's do it.
So yeah, these are our awards that we've been given out since we started this in 2016.
We never changed them.
Yeah, which for some reason we were like, we can never change these. So a lot of these are pretty outdated. And there's certain things like, you know, director maybe, or I don't know, music, things that are very important. We're like, nah, we'll leave them, but we'll keep nebulous stuff like best villain, sequel. Which, yeah, like, you know, some years you don't even get a good villain and you might have amazing films. but, you know.
Yeah, nebulous titles like, let's start with best surprise, shall we?
Yeah, best surprise, which best is surprise. Literally, it means best surprise to us, which I know that's what all the awards are, but obviously this is so specific to us. Because
I'm not gonna lie, when I read the top three just now, I was like, I'm confused.
yeah, we picked these a while ago now.
Yeah,
so I'm like, oh yeah, we picked that, did we? Cool. But yeah,
spoiler alert, this is probably a month since we finished these and then was able to record.
Oh yeah, we were like,
a lot of these are a surprise for us at
this point. We were like, we'll get this podcast wrapped up this year nice and early in early December, and then it just didn't happen. So yeah, best surprise, as always, there is a winner, but first two runner-ups. So yeah, I guess best surprise, first one. Again, most of these we'll have already talked about, so we'll keep these very brief, especially if there's some things that are featured in our top 10, because there's a lot of crossover. But there will be plenty of stuff that we get to talk about for the first time. But this one is no surprise, because a lot of these, we talked about how surprising these films were. But yeah, runners-up, I guess first runner-up would be Unwelcome. Again, I think we just talked about it, but a surprise for me that it ticked all those boxes. I thought it would either just be a fun comedy horror, and that was it. I did not expect such emotional investment and just an overall cohesive, well-adapted film. And yeah, we were looking forward to this for a while. This was one of those ones that you'd kind of picked up on and talked about. But I think it was a case of like, man, I didn't expect it to be, you know, number two of the year based upon
that premise. That's the thing. And then, I mean, talking about surprises, a movie that became, we didn't know it existed, and then it made the top 10 list. No One Will Save You, you know, is the definition of surprise, that the week before we didn't preview it. And then, yeah, here we are at year end talking about it. Just fully delivered, was a fantastic movie, one of the best movies of the year, and absolutely came out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's the definition of, like, for me, what I want from Best Surprise, because it was zero prep going in. It was like, hey, this movie just dropped. Yeah, shall we see it? And then it was like, oh, this movie's awesome. Like, I want that more. I want that. If I could have that every week, that's the dream. But then there are a winner is kind of the counter to that, which is that we had probably active prejudice against it going in, which again is rare for us, but we just talked about it in our top 10, which is Talk to Me. You know, again, it goes without saying, but a brief roundup, like, I actively dislike this genre, and for a movie to come out and be genuinely a breath of fresh air in such an overcrowded, shite, trite genre was unbelievable to me. And so I couldn't believe that I walked out of a cinema possession horror in 2023 and had a good time, because I thought that was impossible.
Absolutely. It really was. But yeah, I guess moving on to Best Death.
It's always a fun one. I like this category.
Yeah, this is fun. You know, it's a horror movie podcast. We've got to talk about Best Death.
Yeah, and this never fails to deliver. We always get such cool ones across everything.
And the first little reference of TV shows, which may be sprinkled throughout this, our little categories from now on. But we have The Death of Perry in The Fall of House of Usher. And again, House of Usher will get referenced again, spoiler alert. But yeah, the kills in this in this TV show were very entertaining and became the finale of each episode. Very quickly, you realize that was the case, and Perry was really the catalyst for that.
Mm.
And it really was the it was such a long, kind of drawn out, foreboding kind of. You know, he was arranging this party. He was like, "Oh yeah, there's just there's some water containers in the top. Yeah, let's just connect them to the fucking system and sprinkler system." And like all of it just was like, "Oh God, what's gonna happen?" And then when it eventually happens, you know, it really, let alone the fact that, like, you know, you had Carla's. This was one of the first times we saw Carla's character, mm-hmm. kind of in this way. You know, having all her interactions and her like whispering to the bar staff and them disappearing and then obviously speaking with Perry and yeah, the way it all played out. And then just to see the, because often you'll get like the money shot, but the fact that we got the aftermath and the episode ended with just these melted bodies of people slowly dying was just very, you know, when Flanagan spoke about this being the most like gory thing he ever has made, he had definitely just shot this for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. This whole sequence with Perry and the acid shower is, oh God, really one of the best things I've ever seen on TV. Like, I love it so much. I remember that feeling that I had when it ended. My jaw was on the floor, I remember, for the first three episodes of this show, the way they ended. And this one in particular was the one that hit me the hardest. Because just visually, it was spectacular. You know, you really don't get to see that level of unbelievable craft when it comes to certain kills. And this was one that was like beautiful in its execution. Like, I almost needed to see it on the big screen, because it was just outstanding how well choreographed the whole thing was. And it is just yet another example of Flanagan being without a doubt one of the best directors in the world. But to then have the storyline reasons for it, to see kind of Verna, you know, her interacting, like, say, her being this like invisible hand, who, this one was great because she almost had no interaction. You know, she at this point in the show, I thought it was going to be more like a Final Destination vibe, where it was just like fucked up accidents, because that's essentially what this was. Whereas obviously later on, she's way more directly involved. She is just actively killing people because of what's going on. Whereas at this point, she was just like, no, I'm just here and I'm gonna like tell people to leave who don't deserve to die, basically. It was outstanding, and yeah, it was a show that we'll reference many times, but the kills in particular, and this kill is like, God, it's so good, man. This show is just spectacular. But it somehow doesn't win. I would say it was probably, well, I don't know, it's really hard because these are all very different, because next up, the runner-up, very different vibe, but is from a movie that we discussed in our top 10, The Menu, The Death of Tyler, which, again, very, very different, very understated. It's nothing to do with the visuals of this. This is purely the emotion. This is all character, all story. I think the story of Tyler and who he is as this kind of pathetic individual who has this obsession with Chef, this obsession with wanting him to appreciate him and notice him. And as soon as Chef cottons onto that, the fact that he then uses that to mentally destroy Tyler to the point that he makes him commit suicide is like one of the most powerful things I've seen in a film. It's really unbelievable that this was just in this film. You know, The Menu has so many other things going on, and this is almost like a Saint Maud level. Like, this could be the story of an indie film.
You forget
film.
That this is not the finale.
No, this is just the way a character dies. And there are many character deaths. And of course, Nicholas Holt is like one of the leads, but it's not even like in the finale, really, I don't think. I think there's quite a lot of the movie still to go. So it's just outstanding. Like, I remember I was gobsmacked because I didn't think he would go that early. I didn't think it would go that way. And when it happened, I couldn't believe how kind of merciless and nonchalant Chef was, he could not give a fuck that what he just did happened. It was just like, yeah, I've done this before and I'll do it again. It was unbelievable.
It really was. I think it really feels like it should be the finale. Because it was the combination. Like you say, this was just a death. It was part of the sequence. It really was spectacular. And it brought together all of the characters, really. Anya's character, obviously Nicholas Holt's, but then also the Ralph Fiennes kind of just dominating performance as well. It was fantastic. As soon as this happened, I was like, this is the winner of Death of the Year.
Yeah, had to be.
We had a great return to form for Chucky this year. And there were a lot of good kills this season, or this part of a season that we got. But this one in particular was the opening of the episode where we get a cameo from Kenan Thompson. And we could pause the show and talk for a few hours about kind of Kenan Thompson and what kind of he means to our childhood and a lot of other things. But let's just say we love Kenan and Kel growing up. And so for him to be in this kind of show, it filled me with joy instantly. And then I was like, oh, fuck, Chucky's going to kill him. That's brilliant. Like, because if you're going to appear on Chucky, you want to get killed, right? You know, that was because who was the WWE? Who do we have?
Oh, God, I can't remember that. I want to say one name, but it's not her name. It's someone else. No. I can't remember anyway, what her name is.
But, you know, that was fantastic. And if you're going to appear on Chucky, you want to get killed. And I was like, oh, Kenan's going to get killed. It's going to be brilliant. But then they went so hard on his kill. And it was so violent and so over the top. And just when you think it's ended, it carries on. For me, you know, this encapsulates kind of what best death is. You know, something like Tyler, the emotional kind of play is fantastic. But for me, this was just a fun, you know, this person that you know, cameo in the show, you're like, oh, they're going to get it. And then to get it in that way was truly spectacular.
Yeah, this is exactly why we've always loved Chucky. It is throwing in a fun cameo. They don't overstay their welcome. They have funny bits. That kind of interaction with him in the backseat and talking to him was great anyway. And then, like you say, the fact that we both were like, oh, he's going to get to kill Kenan, that's awesome. But they go so much harder with it. You know, the level of prosthetics, how long it goes on for, how much they show of it on a TV show. I think it goes so much harder than I ever expected them to go. And like I say, it's consistently been the case with the franchise. To the point, actually, as a fun fact, this is the first time Chucky has won Best Death. However, it has been a runner-up three times.
Wow, really? That's crazy.
Yeah, so that's Cult of Chucky. It's the Child's Play remake and Chucky Season 1. So that shows you that consistently, across all forms, Chucky has always had exceptional kills and deaths, which is obviously the case since the first film. And so to see it finally win, and that was something that I only worked out after the fact, so it's not like we collectively was like, oh, let's finally give it to Chucky.
No, that's right. I had no idea.
Yeah, like I looked up because I was like, man, that's so cool. Because I remember it was like the glass falling on the person in Cult of Chucky. I think it was the Christmas lights in Child's Play remake. And what was it in season one? Oh, it was the it was Junior killing him with the Chucky doll, slamming him down.
That I really wanted to win.
Yeah, like there's so many amazing ones. So yeah, it's so just deserved individually, but also as a franchise, I think it's so deserved. This is awesome. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and like I say, it was a massive return to form, and only four episodes, but it left such an impact. I just cannot wait for those the rest of that season. But yeah, moving on to our big heavy hitters. Ones that we love to talk about. We talk about performances a lot. We talk about how in my opinion, you know, we are at an all-time gold standard for performances across the board. I think it's ridiculous. We have such an embarrassment of riches. And we talk about seeing rubbish things, like The Exorcist was a terrible film that had, like, amazing performances in it. Like, that's just the norm now.
Yeah.
And so when you... To then go from like, okay, so what is that next level? What is that absolute elite tier? And again, the fact that we get to talk about so many is great. So first up is best male performance. And I guess the runner up I should talk about really is one that pains me that it's a runner up. Because I for me, this is the most painful runner up we've ever had doing the show, which is Bruce Greenwood in The Fall of the House of Usher. I think his performance throughout the whole show, obviously the entire show is kind of has this wraparound, this narrative arc, with him having this sit down conversation. It's mind blowing how powerful that performance is, how him talking about all of his children, him talking about his early childhood, how him first meeting the detective, him working at the company, like all of that stuff is, it's so dialogue heavy and it's such a Flanagan-esque thing. You know, like there's a lot of different things. We talked about the acid shower, and that's almost like a precursor, I hope, for what will look like cinematic Flanagan. But I think a lot of times Flanagan at his best, particularly in Midnight Mass, has felt more like you're just watching a great theater show. And that's what these Bruce Greenwood scenes remind me of, is you're just watching unbelievable world-class acting in a very limited setting. It's just a dude sitting in a chair, and he somehow makes that the most charismatic and interesting thing I probably watched all year. Like, it was just outstanding. He was the glue that kept together this unbelievable show that carries through multiple generations, multiple decades, multiple different lives and deaths. But he's the anchor to it all. And if they would have miscast that character, the show would have been substantially worse. Even if they nailed everything else, even if Mark Hamill was still great, even if Carla was still great, even if all the kills were great and the writing and everything, you needed to have the head of the family at the end of the timeline be as strong as it was. And it was almost like a reminder, because Bruce was obviously in Gerald's Game and the earlier kind of Flanagan stuff, but then like was he in Hill House or Midnight Mass? I can't remember.
Yeah, and he was in Midnight Mass.
Was he? Who did he play in Midnight Mass? I can't even remember.
He was the dad.
What, of the drink driver?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's like, yeah, so that speaks volumes that like I can almost not even remember him in it, you know, because there was there was the big other names, you know, like we remember Kate in that, of course, and stuff. And so
shows what an ensemble he's built at this point. That yeah. Like, you know, Flanagan has almost got like 10 names that
can trade in for the lead role.
They can be the lead. And then he has the audacity to just bring in like a Mark Hamill this year. Because you know, Mark Hamill could have easily made this list, and he almost did.
Yeah, he was pretty much fourth.
Yeah, but you know, Bruce's performance was amazing, and I think it was the fact it needed to be so multifaceted that it was kind of, you know, he had these conversations in the room, he had the interactions with his sister, he had the interactions with his children, both alive and dead, and dealing with their deaths. And so he just had so much to do, and he delivered on every part of it. It was fantastic. And I think as well, his performance was strengthened by his, kind of co-actors that were playing the younger versions of him.
Yeah,
because they were all fantastic. So then when we got back to Bruce, we got so much more knowledge of his character, and it made it even better. So it just was just this incredibly strong all round, you know, performance from him that was the sum of all the parts.
That show's almost unfair as well, because I think at a certain point
it really is.
We were like, we could have 8 actors on each of these, and at a certain point it's like we pretty much got it down to one for both, because we were like, well, we can't just fill it with these because of these other names we're about to discuss. Like there's just we are lucky with the level of performance we get.
But TV is good, right?
Very good.
Yeah, next up we have Aaron Paul in his Black Mirror episode, Beyond the Sea.
Mm. First reference to Black Mirror so far.
Let alone Beyond the Sea.
Because,
this episode was just so incredible and was one that start, middle, and end stuck with me. And then the ending just punched me in the face harder than ever. But the thing with Aaron's performance in this was that he had to play so many different things in his own skin. So, you know, he was on the spaceship playing the character that he was meant to play. He was then on Earth playing a synthetic robot of his character being embodied in that synthetic robot. Then he was playing someone else in that skin. So, you know, he was playing three different characters in this episode. And the fact that this, you know, what I've just described, and this is an episode of a TV show. So, you know, we just spoke about Bruce and the fact that how long was he on screen?
Mm.
And it's not to downplay his performance, but Aaron had to play these multiple characters in the skin of his body. Over the course of one episode of a TV show, and it was fantastic. And just the little nuances that he did, you know, he wasn't, you know, when someone else was in his skin, it wasn't over the top, you know, it was almost him, but there was just these tiny little nuances and these little different things that just really showed what a fantastic performance this was.
Yeah, this was outstanding. Like, I think Black Mirror has always had these kind of strong performances. It's something that even in the world of TV that has elevated, I think that's been consistent since season one of Black Mirror and continues to be consistent, is mm-hmm. they bring in big actors like they have now, but they also bring in, you know, we got to see so many newcomers. I mean, Daniel Kaluuya was like in Black Mirror way before he was in films. So you get to see all these different actors, but for Aaron Paul to do what he did, and alongside Josh Hartnett as well, who was excellent in the episode, I think I almost didn't know Aaron could do this. Like, maybe that's my own lack of knowledge, but I'd almost in my mind, and maybe that's just because Breaking Bad is so huge, that like I almost thought, well, he can just really play Jesse, and like it's a bit one note. And I find myself being reductive now, where I'm like, that was so wrong, because he's not I didn't think about Jesse Pinkman once watching this episode. Like, he was a brand new character on screen that he was portraying, and he was doing it in such a high emotional level that was it did remind me of that kind of Matthew McConaughey in Interstellar, just this like unbelievable heightened emotion working off, you know, nothing at times. When you're on this like isolated spaceship, it all has to be internal. You don't get to react to physical things around you with a lot of these other, especially the last performance, which we'll get to, which is a very kind of physical reacting to things in a real world. Aaron Paul's is so much more internal. How is he dealing with what he's just gone through mentally? So it's all in his head, and he has to portray that physically through the performance. And it's outstanding, because you feel every emotion. It's not like overly done. They're not shouting at the audience, here's how this character feels at this time. It's purely through that portrayal of emotion. So he was incredible. Like, it's such a strong episode anyway, Beyond the Sea, like the entire concept. And we kind of both fell in love with it at the time. And obviously his sparring partner, Josh, is equal and is fantastic. But like the journey that Aaron has to go through, and like you say, that ending, and being left with him, it was like, Jesus Christ. I think that feeling is something that pretty much only Black Mirror can achieve, and it achieves it through these amazing performances like what Aaron Paul did in this episode. And I want to see more of Aaron. I really do. I think it's now kind of reignited it for me, where I'm like, I just want to see him in more shit. Maybe we could see him in a TV show. That'd be another TV show. That'd be great.
I think that's the thing that, like, you know, I wouldn't say I was a fan of his.
Mm.
I love Breaking Bad and I love Jesse, but I thought he was just that guy,
yeah,
that played that role. So this was, it blew my mind that he had this level to him, because now, yeah, I whatever he's in, like, I'll be like, oh, okay, like, I'm interested, because he's fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, there can only be one winner this year.
There can indeed.
Which, yeah, we spent a good portion of the start of this year talking about.
I spent all year thinking about it.
Yeah, I feel like we've only just now mentioned it now. But yeah, obviously The Last of Us was huge at the start of this year. It's one of our favorite things ever. And it was no surprise that Mr. Pedro Pascal wins this performance, which, again, I don't want to downplay. And I'm hoping that you'll be able to verbalize it better than I can right now, because I don't want to, again, be reductive and be like, yeah, it's Pedro. We already loved him. He's playing a character that we already love, therefore equals brilliant, because I think that's not remotely the case. I think what he had to do to make this character his own, a character that we've loved and cherished for a decade, you know, portrayed by the incredible Troy Baker, and I'm in a position with this show and the game now that I've never been in with anything else I've ever loved, in that, like, I feel like I've got a foot in these two alternate universes where I get to see different actors portray the same characters in a different medium that I can equally love. And
I think that's
never seen that. I've never seen that before.
You know, with Joel, we love The Last of Us, but we also loved Troy's performance as Joel. And so someone else taking that role felt like wrong. You know, and even when
years, they were like, well, you can't recast Joel and Ellie. That's what people kept saying for so long.
And when they announced the TV show, I was like, we could just make Troy look like Joel. It's fine. And when they didn't do that, I was worried. And then the second they announced Pedro, I was like, oh, okay, they've just announced the guy that, like, I like the most in Hollywood right now, and made me fall in love with a parent and child relationship where the child is an alien that doesn't speak. So if he can do it for that, could he be Joel? Absolutely, he could. And so I felt, you know, when the casting got made, I felt comfortable that it was going to be good, but what he did blew my mind, because he gave Joel this different level of vulnerability, and in the game, Joel was stubborn, and Joel didn't want to fall in love with Ellie, and even when the relationship started to blossom, he just didn't want to, whereas this wasn't a case of not wanting to. Joel was just so vulnerable from having his heart broken, and was so scared to get back to that point again, but also very aware that he was going to. You know, he gets there a lot quicker in the show.
I think the people around him see that as well, with is it Tess? She kind of says that to him, like, she knows what's gonna happen. You know, she knows the path that she's putting Joel on by making him do this mission, which, again, is not in the game or is heavily implied, where it's like they have built a world that they're happy with. But I think she knows, like, listen, I know as much as you're happy with us doing our side gigs and us being in a relationship, but you were put on this earth to be a father, and that's what you need to do now.
And I think that's the thing, that, like, I think the game becomes very much about parenthood and being a father, but almost, you know, like I say, Joel begrudgingly takes that on, whereas this is just absolutely, yeah, Joel's purpose in life is to be a dad. And he lost that for so long. And the second that Ellie came along, he knew what was going to happen. And it upset him so much, because he knew that, you know, being a parent is the most, you know, rewarding and vulnerable and difficult thing in the world, because your child has a cough and you get, like, this crippling anxiety, let alone when you're in a post-apocalyptic world and you've already lost your child and you're now looking after another kid in this world where everything wants to kill you. The infected wants to kill you. The different factions want to kill you. The Fireflies want to kill you. The people that you don't even know around the corner, they want to kill you. And so to adopt this child in this environment is the most kind of heartbreaking, difficult thing I could ever imagine. And I think Pedro just displayed that so well, and I think he did it in a way that wasn't it wasn't over the top, and I think that's why that, like, he wasn't vocal and strong, he was subdued and vulnerable, and it was just all in his face. And I think it was the fact that with Mandalorian he had to give a performance through a mask, you know, and he made us fall in love with two characters, like I say, when one of them is CG and he's wearing a mask. So the fact that he managed to do that just show, you know, he was like, well, this is fucking easy. Like, you know, and he didn't need to go over the top, because suddenly he had way more tools than he's used to, and he already delivered prior. So yeah, he just absolutely smashed it, and there are multiple parts of the show that brought me to tears, and multiple scenes of his that brought me to tears, and just I thought it was, you know, we spoke about the show so much weekly, and it's, I've got it sat there ever since it came out, because I almost don't want to rewatch it, because it makes me so happy knowing it sit there and how good it is, that when I do watch it, I'm just gonna have the time of my life going through it all again.
Yeah, for me, I'm so happy as well that we have this custodian of this character right now, because for as much as people want to act like when you get certain adaptations or certain sequels, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it doesn't take away from the original. It kind of does in certain aspects. For me, this is a video game that has obviously been so close to our hearts for so long. And whilst there are individual games, a few, but not many, that I like more, and there are potentially only a couple of stories that I might like more, there certainly is not a single character that I like as much as Joel and Ellie in any singular video game. And so I was so protective of both of them, and was worried because of the fact that they had, in my opinion, the two best people in the world to play them in the video game world. And I just had no idea how we would ever get those people that would suit it for the TV world. And for them to have done it with Pedro, I'm so thankful for, because as I was saying earlier, it feels like I'm in an alternate universe at times where I get to experience a Joel played by Pedro on TV going forward that I love and I can't wait to see more of. And similarly, in the video game world, we still have more to Joel to come from Troy Baker in the video game world. I think that's so equally exciting, that these two things are going to live parallel right now. And that's so cool. And there is some crossover there with the likes of Neil being involved in the creativity. And we know that Ashley and Troy were obviously involved in the show in some capacity, especially Ashley was incredible. But that's only what you see on screen, which I think is more of like a glorified cameo. I think what happens off screen is where the real work happens. They are, because you know, they talk about it a lot. Troy and Ashley care about these characters and Neil more than anyone else in the world. And so they knew that they had to get the right people. Like, they are not going to take this lightly. And there is a third character that is going to be added to this dynamic going forward that equally they're going to have to take as much care as they were this time. And that's the thing that fills me with right now. You know, I'm not worried because they've done it once. And it's the same people having to do that again. So I'm sure they'll be able to do it again, even though it's very difficult. But they did it. They did the thing that I thought was impossible in terms of, I now equally love these two things in different mediums, in different forms, which is great. Yeah. But yeah, moving on to best female performance. And also, yeah, that was a complete shutout for TV on the male performance.
Yeah, I know.
Crazy. Yeah, incredible. Like, those three. I mean, The Last of Us, Black Mirror, and Fall of House of Usher were just ridiculous. But yeah, best female performance. Do you want to give us our first runner-up?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while. We should probably talk about TV. Yeah, another very difficult runner-up for Fall of House of Usher is the incredible Carla Gugino, which, you know, she's been a staple of Flanagan right since Gerald's Game. But, you know, when she appeared in this show, she was just captivating, and every scene she was in, she stole the show. In a show that, you know, we've already spoken about, has got about 10 standout performances, But the second, it didn't matter what was going on. Mm. If she was in shot, I was staring at her. And it was intentional. That's exactly what Flanagan wanted, but it takes someone of Carla's screen presence, her beauty, her just all-round dominating persona to be able to take your attention like that when you've got all of these other powerhouses around you. And, you know, she absolutely does it. The scene in the bar where we get her way more vocal and way more kind of loose and chatty than we do in any other kind of scenes in the show is fantastic. We get to see a different side to her. And then, yeah, seeing her just kind of just mop up, I guess, the entire Usher family was just absolutely fantastic. And in the kind of those final scenes, it was just a joy to watch her kind of deliver because at that point, I was so confident in the performance that I could just enjoy it, which is so rare that you get to do that. And you know, I could absolutely do that with Carla in those final scenes of House of Usher. So yeah, it was a standout performance for the year for sure.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point in a show where it is just filled with so many incredible performances and characters. They are able to create this almost aura around her with this character, and that's exactly what the character calls for. Like, it needs to feel special. You know, you have this big family, you have also other casts of recurring characters, but she's weird. She's a unique element. She's the unexplainable thing in this story. She needs to be the crazy firework that's thrown in that's unexplainable. And she creates that dynamic beautifully. And obviously it's the way it's written and the way it's shot, but you need to then have someone that can carry the mantle, because that's a big, you know, shoes to fill, to be like, every time you're on screen, you need to be captivating, you need to be interesting and very unpredictable. You know, you spend a vast majority of the TV show trying to work out what she even is, what's her point in all of this, what is she, you know, is she even anything that we can even describe? So that all then comes from the performance as well, to add to that, to be like, it needs to be dynamic and interesting every single time. And then, yeah, just her, like, level of charm is remarkable. You can just hear her talk for days, and it's perfect, because it would just, we would all fall for the same scam the second she starts talking to you. It's just perfect. And also, it's worth noting that this is the second time Carla has been a runner-up, with the first being 2017 in Gerald's Game. So yeah, twice now a runner-up for Carla, which just shows her consistency, of course, across film and television, but obviously in the Flanagan verse. And then moving on to a rare film nomination. Little spoiler alert, but this is the only performance in a film that will be on these two categories, which again is just shows you the level of quality for TV. But this is Micah Monroe in God is a Bullet. Again, already touched upon it, so I'll give a brief rundown, but obviously I said it at the time, it is my favorite performance of hers. She's an unbelievable actress. I think when we first saw her in It Follows, it was like, oh, this is a really cool, exciting new emerging talent. And the way she has then taken that ball and ran with it, I think her performance in Villains was so good as well. And then to bring us now to God is a Bullet, her entire relationship as this kind of captive person, then breaking free, she's just, I think she can do it all. She's so good at everything we've ever seen her in, and I would love, she again, I don't want to lose her to TV as well, but like, she's someone that if we only get to see her at most for like 90 minutes at a time on screen, and that's in a long ass film like God is a Bullet, so like, I would love to see her for like 6 hours. Like, what would you know, what type of performance in a HBO,
what could she do?
Yeah, what would she be like in a quality Flanagan or HBO level show? Like, it would just be unbelievable. But yeah, she is so good and a worthy runner-up on this list.
Yeah, she was amazing. And I think as well, like, the more removed we are from the movie made the top 10. And I think the movie made the top 10 because of her performance.
Mm.
More so than probably a lot of others in this performance category. You know, we've spoken about House of Usher, we spoke about Aaron Paul's performance, but he still needed a counter body in that. You know, Micah Monroe just got Bob. and
he's getting bashed so much.
But of course, there's only got to be one winner when it comes to performance, and The Last of Us is going to have to clean up again because it was Bella Ramsey in her portrayal of Ellie. This one was very different because when she was cast, I was unsure. In the first episode, I was unsure. And then the more I got to see her and her version of Ellie, the more I fell in love with it. And then she delivered some parts that were just, you know, just blew my mind. And certain scenes in particular where they were line for line, the same as the video game, brought such different emotions from Bella's performance. And I think that's why she ended up, you know, winning this category as well as Pedro for male performance. You know, very, very different reasons, but both, they just played off each other so well in the end, and it was so powerful to see them both on screen together.
Yeah, I agree. For me, I think Ellie is harder to portray. I think that, again, I didn't want to take it away from Pedro in the slightest, but I think we've seen him play more similar roles to Joel in the past, and it was more of a, you could see it before you had to see it. Whereas I think with Ellie, it's so incredibly diverse in terms of how different she changes throughout the course of just the first game, and so therefore this first season. And she really did a good job of, again, it felt like Ellie, but she did take it in different directions. She was a lot more kind of feral and a lot more engaged in the violence. You know, there are these moments where she is happy to be in this situation at times. And I think that's such an interesting take on Ellie and where she's going to go. I thought she did a brilliant job of portraying this character up until this point just be so happy with her. I think going forward, as a kind of aside, I'm very, I want to be optimistic, but if I'm being honest, I am slightly worried, because I think what Bella did in this first season portraying Ellie up until this point has been brilliant. But knowing what we know about Ellie going forward in part two, right now I do struggle to see it. And I'm hoping that that's a lack of imagination on my part, and I'm sure that they're incredible, that they'll do slight ways of adapting it and making it work. So, like, I'm sure this is not going to be an issue, but I am worried because Ellie from game one to game two is a different type of character. It's still Ellie, of course, but she needs to do a lot of different things going forward.
Yeah, her hardest performances are yet to come.
Yeah, it's not even close.
I think that was why, you know, when we discussed this, we were like, does she win because of that? But we cannot judge her on what she has not yet done.
No, not in the slightest.
And we can only judge her on what she's done, and what she's done is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you that her hardest work is still yet to come for this character, for sure.
Yeah, like we might get to a point after potentially two more seasons where we go, oh, it wasn't right. You know, again, that sounds so harsh right now because of what we've seen has been so brilliant, and she's absolutely worthy of this award. But yeah, that is purely just for someone who, again, has experienced both at the time and loves them both for different reasons, which is what we are. And that is very much the minority of the audience of The Last of Us, because it is this huge success. It's just something that we both consider. Yeah, we will have to see on that one. But yeah, The Last of Us winning both. That's very rare, actually. Off the top of my head, the last time it was kind of both performances in the same thing was A Quiet Place.
I was going to say, would it have been Quiet Place?
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure it's never, even in the, and obviously it's more consistent with a TV show because you'd think with Flanagan, but I'm pretty sure we've had different winners in different years, but never been the same. And that's crazy that a movie got both of them as well. Like, that's so rare. But so yeah, moving on to best concept, which again, we can kind of go through these first couple of runners up pretty quickly. The first runner up is The Menu, which again, we've discussed, but I think that, yeah, that concept is really cool. And I think this is more a case of when it comes to best concept, there's certain other things like Knock at the Cabin, for example, that like before I'd seen it, I'm like, that's an amazing concept. But then when you see the realization of the concept, it didn't work. So this is equally both, it's the concept, but then do you actually realize it? And I think that's the difference, is that The Menu could have been terrible and is somehow sensational. And that's why it deserves to be a runner up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, like you say, it's such a cool idea, but it's also how it delivered on all of the different things that we spoke upon, and really was just a neat package and a movie that I really do want to watch again for sure. Yeah, next up on the list is Unwelcome, our number two movie of the year. You know, already spoken about it a lot, but I think that the concept, so many different things about it, but just I think as well, just the Britishness of the concept and how that's woven with the kind of Irish kind of folklore and all of it was just so well done and just such a joy to be able to watch this year for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, our winner is an episode of Black Mirror, but not one we've discussed so far. Which is why the season was so strong, which is Lock Henry, which, yeah, we talked about it in our specials. But, yeah, this concept, you know, a guy making a documentary, this boring level documentary, it then spins into this murder mystery type documentary involving his family, which I think is an amazing concept anyway. But then when you think about the meta levels to this, particularly with this being put on Netflix, a company which I've been very critical of in recent years in terms of their, in my opinion, glamorizing certain serial killers and documentaries. And there is this, there's so many people that's their favorite thing that I've spoken to, where they're like, what do you watch? Oh, I just watch true crime documentaries. And I get it. Like, it's so goddamn addictive. But, like, I have a problem with it overall in terms of its portrayal. I don't think it's necessarily a fair reflection when you give all the attention to a killer. At times you cast a very popular good-looking actor to play said killer, and you then gloss over the victims. I get very uncomfortable with it. And it's not only Netflix either, is you know, there's many different channels and companies that are a problem here.
I was going to say we've just gone through it over here in England with a Jimmy Savile documentary.
Yeah,
where I've had multiple people say to me, "You've got to watch it for the performance. The performance is amazing." And I'm like, I do not want to see someone do an amazing version of the most villainous character that's ever lived in England.
Mm.
Like, I just don't want to see it. And I've not watched one second of it, and I'm sure he did an amazing job, but I do not want to see him do an amazing job as someone that I detest, you know? And I think that's, you know, the problem with a lot of these shows, and I think that's what, you know, Lock Henry does a great job of pointing a finger at and kind of saying, you know, that this is getting a bit silly now and what it can actually do.
For sure, and I think the way it concludes is what really... It was like amazing, but then that last like 5 minutes was something that I still think about. That, you know, getting the awards, getting the, oh my God, isn't it so great that you put a spotlight on this? Wow, everyone in the world cared about this for 5 minutes before they then moved on to the next true crime doc. And then you're suddenly sat there in your room, your family has been destroyed, and you've got nothing left except for this award to show for it. It was like unbelievable. I loved Lock Henry so much. I think Black Mirror has done certain realizations of tech flawlessly. This was like, and obviously this season was very different, and this is the episode in particular. Obviously the other one was really great, but this is like a thing that I wanted to see taken down that isn't necessarily tech related that they did so beautifully. That's it's something that I've been saying to people for the last probably 3 or 4 years that I wasn't able to perfectly articulate how I felt about it. And now I say to people, I would say watch Lock Henry. That's how I feel about this trend. Like, it's just the perfect way. Like, Charlie did the thing perfectly that I couldn't say because he's amazing at this. Worthy winner.
Next up is a weird category because this one over the years we've struggled with.
Yeah.
It's best sequel/remake.
Yeah.
And there have been years where bad movies have got into this list because we have not got three of them.
Yeah, it's a very stupid category.
It is, but we will stick with the rules. This is what we decided year one, and we will die on that hill, goddammit.
Yep.
But this year, all three movies are in our top 10, which is the first time that's ever happened, gotta be, for this category.
Yeah, definitely. That's crazy.
Like I said, I think some years there's been ones in our worst of that have made the top three because there just hasn't been a third one. But anyway, coming to our first runner-up, we've got Saw X. You know, we've already spoken about this a lot, but the fact that we got a great Saw movie in 2023 was amazing. The fact that the Saw movie being as good as what it is and Saw being a franchise that we love as much as we do, the fact that that's not won this category, you've already heard our top 10, so you know why. But if you didn't, then you know, most other years, that wins this category for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And the only slight clarification I'll give with this category is that it's basically best franchise film. So obviously, Saw X is technically a prequel, so it's fine. And also, it's not the best film that happens to be a franchise film. It's which film is the best at being either a prequel or a sequel or a remake. And so that's why we talk about these three films and we'll talk about the winner. But yeah, Saw X is a great prequel. And it adds to that flavor. I think if you're only a fan of those early films, you can watch just the first three and watch Saw X and have a great time. But yeah, next up is VHS 85. Which actually, VHS has been a runner-up the last 3 years in a row now. So since it's come back on Shudder, it's always made the list. It just has never got over the line and won. But yeah, we talked about our top 10. I love VHS. I have nostalgia for VHS, which is probably a weird way of putting it because it's not like an 80s film. But like VHS has always been in my life, it feels like. And so I've kind of... Now we're in that second wave of films, I'm happy. And for as long as it continues, I will continue to enjoy it. And it was just another great entry, as we discussed earlier.
Definitely. But this year, there can only be one winner, and that is Scream 6. Obviously, our movie of the year, but also the best sequel, because not only is it a sequel to the preceding five films and a great sequel to those, it's a fantastic sequel to Scream 5 because it actively makes Scream 5 better. And I think, you know, we've spoken about it being the best movie of the year, but in terms of it being the best sequel, that is why, because Scream 5 has definitely gone up in my estimations now I've seen Scream 6. And so, yeah, that's why it had to win this category for sure.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think anytime I want a sequel, I want it to better the thing that it's adding to. And this absolutely does that. Scream 6 makes Scream 5 a better film. Therefore, it deserves to win this category, let alone the fact that the overall movie is as good as it is.
Yeah, it's all right.
Also, Scream goes from being a runner-up last year to winning this year. So that's very nice as well. And then, yeah, final two categories, our best villain category, which is always hilarious. But our shout out.
I love that we hate our own categories.
Yeah, this is what happens when you were doing it for as long as we have. But our first runner up.
I'm like, we decided this for.
I know we're like the jaded viewer disagreeing with it. It's like we picked this, but this is what happens when we pick it a month ago.
Because
our opinions have changed. Yeah. But yeah, our first runner-up on the best villain category, God, how did this not win? Is the great John Carver in Thanksgiving?
I was wondering that when I read this,
because we talked about it at the time. You know, we want to see these new waves of the classic horror villains, and no, you know, I don't need that in all my films. Movies like Midsommar are just amazing horror films. But I like to see what is a modern take on Jason, and I think that's exactly what John Carver is. He is rooted in 80s aesthetic, but with a modern twist. He uses modern tech to kill people and to talk to them and to, you know, put them in misery. And that's what we want our great villains to do. So yeah, I love John Carver. He was great.
Yeah, he really was. He really was. But he didn't win.
No, he didn't win.
Also a really great runner up is Chef Slowick from The Menu. Obviously Ralph Fiennes, you know, standout performance in a movie that was in our top five. He really was just like you said, you know, seeing him as Voldemort, he was fantastic, but was in a, you know, had to reel it in. Whereas with this, he could fully go, and just to see him fully go, I'm like, man, I need Ralph Fiennes cast as a villain more and more after seeing this movie.
Definitely.
Because I feel like this award is more Ralph Fiennes as a villain than the character Chef. Because Chef could have been easily throwaway if it was someone else.
Yeah.
And the movie wouldn't have been as good, but it still would have been good. But the only reason why Chef is in our top three is because it was played by Ralph Fiennes, absolutely for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, oh yeah, Ralph's in a horror film, you know. Mm-hmm. but yeah, our winner is Cecilia from Saw X, which is extremely different to our two runners-up. You know, you're talking about a great performance and then also just like a new take on a horror icon. For me, Cecilia deserves best villain because she is without a doubt the most horrible person I saw in a film all year. You know, this category is normally more fun and more in jest, whereas I think this was taken more literally of like, she is just a scumbag. And it was, I think Saw as a franchise always has strong scumbags when it's at its best. You know, we want good people as well, or people that can potentially change. But I think fundamentally, I just like seeing pieces of shit get destroyed in traps.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. And that was a glaring mistake and error to the said film that we discussed, you know, like Cecilia getting a pretty abysmal trap that she easily won, and then that was it, was easily my least favorite part of Saw X, and is definitely what knocked it down a peg or two for me. I'm hoping now that they've now established a villain in Saw that I detest, and I cannot wait to see hopefully Hoffman track her down and kill her. So that's something exciting for the future. And so yeah, I have to give them credit for that, because I don't think many horror franchising, particularly Saw, like, you know there are good villains, but they are typically like, oh, this guy's a piece of shit, he's a drunk driver, or he sells drugs to kids. She's like awful, man. Like, everything about her, whether it was her ability to immediately throw her friends and co-workers under the bus, or the fact that she would just openly want to harm and kill a child, like, she was so cold-blooded and awful in every single way. And they have to act upon this in a sequel. They've set brilliant groundwork here, and if they don't deliver, I need to see her die in an incredible way in the next Saw, otherwise I'm going to retroactively take away this award.
That's what annoys me, is that she was such a great villain and we needed her death.
Mm.
But it still doesn't take away from what a good villain she was. But yeah, coming to probably the strongest category we've ever had,
mm-hmm.
For any of our kind of subcategories at year end, but this is our best TV for 2023.
Mad.
Christ. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. But we've spoken about it a couple of times. It's been runner up twice. And it's now runner-up for a third time. And that's The Fall of House of Usher. Flanagan just doing Flanagan shit. And he just continues to be a joke, really, where he, you know, on paper, this shouldn't work nearly as well as it does. But he is just a master of his art. And, you know, he has this just ensemble of world-class actors and actresses, and then the fact that he adds to it with each iteration of his works that he does. I don't know where his ceiling is, because every time he does something that I think might be his best thing, he then goes and does something like this, you know, because I thought Midnight Mass was his pinnacle.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what my favorite thing is, whether it's House of Usher or Midnight Mass. You know, when we reviewed it, I said, I think it's still Midnight Mass. I think still, just personally, how much it spoke to me, Midnight Mass. But there are so many parts of this that are just so incredibly strong. And just seeing the family kind of slowly succumb to this curse was just, it was such a macabre joy to see it unwind, and with Carla at the helm. And yeah, it was just such a fantastic show.
Yeah, this show is just ridiculous. Like, the more I think about it, the more I love it. I already want to rewatch it, and it wasn't even that long ago. I think that, like, it might be my favorite thing I watched all year across everything. It's very close between a few things, but I think for me, it was an original story. Like, a lot of the other things I loved this year were either working in franchises that I love or with different adaptations, whereas obviously I'm not familiar with what he's taken here, and I know a lot of it is just original anyway. But yeah, this was just a brand new story from Flanagan that floored me. And yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily his best, because I think the personal level of Midnight Mass is ridiculous, but in terms of my own favorite, it's easily my favorite. It speaks to me the most, because I think it was his most fun. It has his best kills. I think it has such a stunning finale, and also it's not slow started. I've said that before about his previous shows, which I have rewatched them, and I stand by it. That I do think the episode one in particular of his shows typically aren't the best. I couldn't believe how good episode one of this show was. Like, again, I was like, my jaw was dropped from the first episode. So he somehow has able to land immediately, and normally the payoff is obviously absolutely worth it, but I don't know how he was able to get me to love it immediately. And so, yeah, I adore this show. It's incredible. Like, he is just a genius. He is one of the best. He might be the best guy. We have so many to choose from. We're so lucky in this era. And it's almost just like, yeah, today I feel like I just want to watch The Lighthouse, or today I want to feel like I just want to watch Us. But pound for pound, I don't know, maybe Flanagan might be the best. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, he's out of this world.
Yeah, he's insane. But yeah, another runner-up, again, what we mentioned before, but Black Mirror, season 6, obviously returning after a big, long hiatus. I think it was like 3 years. And actually, so Black Mirror has obviously heavily featured on this since we started the show. It previously won for season 3, which was obviously the first one on Netflix, the San Junipero season. It was a runner-up for the season 4, which was also brilliant. And then season 5 completely missed out, which, yeah, looking back on this now, I'm like, yep, all of that checks out for me. Because I do think this is on par with season 4, and it's not as good as season 3, and is definitely way better than season 5. And it was a return to form. It was the most different the show's ever been. It had some zany, wacky shit in it, which, again, at the time I was there for. I have no idea. I've rewatched Black Mirror probably more than any other TV show. Actually, I definitely have, because I rewatch it all the time. And obviously, because it is just these, like, random episodes, and it's way shorter than TV shows. Easier. So yeah, I've seen like my favorites, you know, 5, 6, 7 times. And yeah, I don't think, you know, like the werewolf one, for example, I'll probably rewatch it and I might not like it, but I loved it the first time. I was like in it for the ride. I like correctly called this ridiculous twist, which I was so happy with. Demon 79, again, I was on for the ride. And then let alone the, again, the first episode I'm not mentioning, because I didn't like the first episode. So that is the reason why it gets knocked down. Whereas there was 2 very enjoyable episodes. And then, of course, the 2 exceptional episodes that we've already mentioned, with the particular Lock Henry, is something that I'll always want to discuss. So yeah, very worthy runner-up Black Mirror, but it was considerably behind Usher and then our winner.
It was, and I think it was those 2 episodes really where, you know, Lock Henry and Beyond the Sea were just so incredible. And the other episodes, they had their moments, but yeah, those 2 were out of this world. But yeah, there has to be only one winner this year. You know, early on, as soon as it started, and I've never watched a weekly TV show multiple times every week because I just could not get enough of it. I watched one episode like 7 times.
Yeah, I know. I was like, how did you find the time for this?
I don't even know. I genuinely don't know. But yeah, there has to be only one winner, and that is The Last of Us. The best adaptation of a video game, the best TV show of the year, the best adaptation of kind of any pre-existing thing, almost, you know. Having Neil at the helm was key to this being as good as what it was. It absolutely would not have delivered on this level, you know. Best TV show, best male actor, best female actor, is all due to the fact that he was there steering the ship the whole way. And yeah, it was phenomenal. They hit all of the major beats of the video game, but then they gave us, diehard fans of the video game, these different beats and these different moments, and both equally stay with me as much, which is the thing that's shocking, where I thought that the bits from the game would be the bits that leave me quicker because I've already experienced them, but they both stick with me equally. And yeah, the show was just a joy from start to finish. And yeah, I absolutely can't wait to start it again.
Yeah, it was just an amazing adaptation. Like, I think for us loving this story for so long, and we've played it across multiple generations of PlayStation now, I was wondering, like, am I going to be sick of it? Like, I've seen these scenes so often now, and are they still going to have the impact? And watching that first episode with Joel and his daughter, it was like, I couldn't believe that it worked again. It put me back in 2013 when I first played that game on the PlayStation 3 and felt all those emotions. And I was like, I can't believe a video game can do this, can have such a in-depth adult story with this level of performance. And so to then see that adapted on like a HBO elite level television show, was so fulfilling as a fan that has seen certain things get dragged over to different mediums that just don't feel right. And it's interesting whether or not we're going to get, you know, stuff like Metal Gear Solid and BioShock that are, you know, considered the absolute best in video games along with The Last of Us. And are we going to see, because, like, for example, I like Halo, but I'm not like a big Halo fan, but there was like a Halo TV show that was dreadful. And we've seen obviously plenty of other adaptations that just aren't even remotely close to what the source material is. But I think Last of Us is special in the sense that it really is one of these, I would consider it in like a class with maybe two or three others. You know, you're talking Kojima stories, you're talking BioShock. That's probably it in all of video games. And I am talking with authority because I feel like I've played video games my whole life. In terms of story-based video games, I'm very familiar with what's out there in terms of narratives. And I've not seen anything that's on the level of those three.
No, and The Last of Us really was the gold standard for sure.
Yeah, like what Naughty Dog did was ridiculous. And so it was so set up to fail. And it's like, yes, you got great people in. Yes, HBO consistently put out great TV. But I never expected it to be this good. Like I say, that it was a match made in heaven getting Craig Mazin, who'd obviously worked on HBO shows before, for him to be the TV guy, for Neil to be the Last of Us guy, for them to be almost like they were made to write stuff together. It just feels like a perfect duo.
I was going to say, the fact that they linked up so well, you know, because they were the two best people to work together.
Yeah.
But then the fact that they became bros instantly just made it work, you know, to a level that no one could have anticipated.
Yeah, and I think like Craig's TV brain, when he asked Neil certain questions about, so why was it this way in the video game world, and Neil would explain why from a video game design perspective, and then Craig would then say, well, why would it make a lot more sense on the TV world, and it would almost always be correct. And I love having that voice in that world now, where I think it's going to enrich the video game world. You know, when if we ever live to see part three, I would love to have Craig be in Neil's ear giving him advice, because I think for the most part there was very rare misfires when it comes to what they directly changed, whether it was small or big. I think the kind of female villain arc that they had for a couple of episodes is easily the biggest misfire, and that in itself is a very small thing in the grand scheme of things, but that was pretty much the only thing. You know, the Bill and Frank episode 3 obviously talked about massively, but it can't be understated how inconsequential and irrelevant that is in a video game, and how it is arguably one of the best things of the TV show. And some people try and use that as a slight, like, wow, isn't it hilarious that the best part of the TV show isn't even in the game? And it's like, you're so brain dead if that's what you're trying to angle this as. They're enriching the original story by adding an even greater element to it. So you're just completely missing the point. And it would have been nice if they'd had certain small things. Like, I think hardcore fans like ourselves wanted a character called Ish to kind of be more filled out. And I think that was a layup. I don't know how Neil missed that personally, but it is what it is. Like, it, again, it's not perfect. When you're this involved like we are, and you, for people that listen to those shows every week, you know there is very few things we love as much as this. We couldn't be more happier about it. Yes, we're going to find the tiniest, smallest super fan things to complain about, but my God, is this show... I mean, I said it at the time, it's my second favorite show ever, so I can't really be more complimentary about it.
It really was out of this world.
And yeah, I just can't wait until we get more of it, hopefully one day. It would be nice to finally see all these TV shows come back. But so yeah, that is it for our individual awards. We have made it. We've made it another year. Can you believe it?
Barely.
We fell over the line at the end. Like, I feel like
we really did.
Everything's trying to stop us. Your voice is gone, and we're just... Everything's like, you cannot record this best of. It should have been done 3 weeks ago, but we finally done it.
My God, we did it. We did it somehow.
Yes, we did. But yeah, that was the year. That was 2023, in a nutshell. But yeah, going forward, we had a big announcement that I teased at the start of the show, which if you've listened for this long, and you're still with us, you're probably not going to like this one. So, unfortunately,
you're a fan at this point.
Yeah, you know, if you were expecting an excitement announcement, I didn't say that earlier. I caught you. get baited. Because yeah, it's not a great one. If you're a fan of the weekly shows, because yeah, we are going into the new year in 2024, there will be no more weekly shows covering new horror every single week, every single Wednesday. Obviously, we've been doing that grind. So this is we're just 2 months shy of our 8-year anniversary. Obviously started right at the start of March 2016, which is insane. That's so much longer than I ever could have imagined us doing it on the level that we did it for. It was nearly 400 weeks.
Hard for a long while.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's nearly 400 weeks that we've kind of been doing this. Yeah, because this is show 374, so obviously it's mostly a weekly show. We take off a couple of shows. Pretty much 90%, I'd say, of the last 8 years we've had a show up. We've covered around 348 new horror films, let alone all of the other stuff we've covered. And yeah, it's been insane, but it is a grind, you know, to watch new stuff every week, to then talk about it, to move on to the next thing. It's a lot. And I think we both got to the point that we wanted to just talk about things we enjoy. And it's a shame because, yeah, it's great when you find, as we've discussed in this episode, stuff like No One Will Save You. You know, going forward, I probably just won't watch a film like that. And that is a shame. But there's only so many hours in the day, and we have to focus on a lot of other things in our lives, and we have to focus on the things that we know we're going to love. And so, yeah, going forward, like I said before, there are no more weekly shows covering new horror. As it stands right now, we don't know what's next. We have nothing planned for at least a few months, at the very least. However, we would like to still just talk about things we love. As we mentioned, you know, next year has Flanagan, has Jordan Peele, has Robert Eggers. You know, we're going to get the last season of The Stranger Things, which we'll absolutely want to talk about.
Not next year.
But we will get The Last of Us at some point. Those two are probably both 2025. But films wise, looks pretty exciting next year. So we would like to talk about them, but that will be very sporadically. This won't be, you know, going live at a certain time, at a certain day of the week, with a certain length, with an intro, talking about news. We're not going to talk about news anymore, unless that's the thing that we wanted to come and talk about. You know, it could be a case of, hey, Mike Flanagan's directing A Nightmare on Elm Street, let's talk about that. And that could just be a thing where we just hit record and shoot the shit for as long as we want. But yeah, there's no, the schedule is no more. This is just a nebulous thing now that exists whenever we want to use it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, if you're a fan of the show, then we hope you stay subscribed. But we can't promise when we'll be back. It's a case of doing it when it feels right, doing it when the timing's there. You know, it's you know, the fact that we've done it for almost 8 years, when we've got full time jobs and lives and other things that get in the way. You know, and the fact that we've done it weekly, and the fact that we've dedicated bank holiday weekends going to Fright Fest and all different things like that.
The amount of weekends where we go to, you know, we go to see a film at the weekend and then we record on a weekday. So that's like two nights that is taken up with the podcast, which is great. Yeah. But again, doing that for so long, it's even if we said, oh yeah, we'll just do it monthly or something. But I do think we probably, I mean, we've done it for a long time, but I think we grinded so hard for so long. I can't believe it now when I look back on it, and it's almost gone in the blink of an eye, really. Like I think those early days, but I can't believe it's been 8 years of covering new horror every single week. It's mad.
When you said like 400 weeks, I was like, that can't be right. And then I started to do the math in my head. I was like, fuck, that's how maths work.
Yeah.
I'm like, Jesus, that's obnoxious. Of course, we're on episode, you know, 300 or whatever.
374.
And it's like, yeah, you know, that does take its toll apparently on my voice more than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that's why now it's a case of this can be something that we can enjoy when it feels right, you know. When a big movie comes out, we'll want to watch it. We're still going to watch cinema horror. We're still going to watch new horror. But we don't have to be stuck with this kind of, you know, time to you know, this year has been very difficult to keep to the weekly slot. And it became very clear that next year we're not going to be able to do that. And with the struggle we've had this year. And so it's taken those chains off. And, you know, if we see three movies in 3 weeks and we have time to record three podcasts, we'll record three podcasts. If we don't do a podcast for 6 months, we don't do a podcast for 6 months. And you know, that's going to be the agenda from now on, which, you know, is a shame. And you know, it is probably going to be a shame for people that have listened to the last 2 or 3 hours of what we've just spoken about, if you're still listening. But it feels right for us. And we hope that, you know, it continues to still be a thing within its new format.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I understand it if it is a shame, but like, I really, for me personally, and I can only speak for that, is like, I'm just so proud of what we've achieved for so long, because it's really mind blowing. Like, looking back on it now and seeing how much content we put out on a weekly basis for people. And again, it's like, we did this all just for fun, and I've loved it. We have not made a penny off the show. You know, it is actively a minus on that, having to see films. But that's fine. You know, like we've loved every second of it, and it's been great to experience certain different things, whether it's going to Fright Fest and getting to cover those films. Certain partners, for example, Shudder, have been amazing for us on the podcast. Like, they've always been the easiest people to work with. They give us access to stuff, so we can always talk about it in a timely fashion, and that's been great. But yeah, I'm so glad we don't have that kind of forced. What you just said is like the perfect reason as to what's been the toughest about it. Is it starts to feel like a job when you feel like you have to put out a show every week, when the content isn't there. We don't have a show that is not based upon outside factors. Since day one, we have to adhere to what is coming out, what is the release schedule of certain films. And that is why sometimes you'll get screwed because three horror films come out on the same day. But they don't care about that, you know. But for us, that sucks. We would love a new interesting horror movie to cover every week, but that's just not how this works.
No, and I think, you know, what you said there with, you know, definitely Shudder have been a huge help to us, you know, and especially in recent times, because they gave us access to things so early that actually helped our schedule, because we knew, oh, okay, we've got 3 weeks to watch this movie now before we can talk about it. And that's quite nice to not have that kind of rush that we sometimes have. And certainly kind of getting to know people like Richard Brake on a personal level was fantastic. But for me, like, we started this podcast for a means for us to have a conversation with each other and just get to see movies together on a regular basis and talk to each other on a regular basis. And we never thought anyone would ever listen to this.
Yeah.
So the fact that, like, when we got those first fan kind of interactions and, people that have been talking to us for years has just blown my mind. And to be honest with you, it's why the podcast has gone on as long as it has, because for a long time you know, I think we've got to the point where it's like, oh, okay, well, we can see movies together and talk about them without the podcast. We do that. We go see Mission Impossible, etc. But we almost felt like we've built this fan base and we don't want to leave this fan base. And I think that's the most difficult part to leave behind now is those people that have been listening for so long. Either the people that have listened to hundreds of episodes and never sent a message, people that are listened to the last few, or the people that have been vocal, just knowing that there's a community out there that listen is the difficult part to leave behind. You know, but hopefully we're not fully leaving it behind. And hopefully when an episode does go live, there will be a community still there to listen to it.
Yeah, for sure. Like that's always the part that's just mind blown to me. And it's really hard to even take in. Just how many people have listened to us over the 8 years. Because you either, you know, you always have a cycle of people dropping in, people dropping out. That's like any content. Or, and then you also have that core people where, you know, there is multiple people, you know, that have listened for years, dating back to that first year and that ropey first podcast to then really getting into the swing of things in 2017. And it's just crazy to think that there's that many people, like say that, and we know certain people that have been long-term listeners that have reached out, and that's awesome that they've made themselves known in the community, and we know them through stuff like social media. But then, yeah, there is, as always with everything, the silent majority, you know, because I know from my own experience, that's what I am with all the things I'm a fan of.
I absolutely am that as well.
There's literally a person that I've followed for probably 18 years now in the gaming space, and I've never interacted with them once. And it's like, it's crazy to think that I've listened to that person talk for probably hundreds of thousands of hours at this point, or certainly tens of thousands. Like, it's crazy. But yeah, that's what it is for people. And I think, yeah, that's where you feel a bit of guilt sometimes, is like, I think for the podcast, this is absolutely the best decision. And on a personal level for us, it is. I do feel that guilt, because I know for so many people, getting that new weekly thing to get you through your commute or your job or however you listen to the podcast, it's so great. And because that's how, what I use it for as well. And so that's the only thing that I'm like disappointed, is that for a lot of people, they won't get that now and they'll have to find that elsewhere. And I know how difficult that was for me. That's the whole reason why we started this show, is because we didn't know someone that was covering new horror to the extent that we wanted to cover it. And I'm so proud of that back catalog when you look at it now, that we've covered for this period of time, you know.
Yeah, like you say, we went so hard for the last nearly 8 years,
yeah, covering like 350 new horror films in that period of time. It's just crazy. Like, and again, there are certain other avenues, but they either switch out people or whatever. It's always us. Like, it's us too, giving our thoughts on these things. That's crazy for that long. So yeah, hopefully it all makes sense anyway. The only other thing I did have in my notes was, we haven't recorded the kill switch yet.
Kill switch has not been recorded. No. This is true.
So the kill switch has not been engaged, but you know, so that means that does mean something for long-term listeners. The kill switch has not been recorded. But as of right now, like I say, this is the first time since we've done the show where the second we stop recording, there is no plan for the next episode. That's like the easiest way to describe it. It will just be whenever.
And when you see that movie title on the feed, you know that there are still more episodes to come.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know you need to see the, because yeah, we will do that, I promise you. Like, there will be a kill switch at some point if we feel the need to do so, but now is not the time.
If we get like a year down the line and we've not recorded the show, we're sitting down and doing some Terminator 2.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, if we've not done the show in all of 2024, then yes, we will do the kill switch at the end of the year. But yeah, crazy times for the show. And a mad one to end it on, really. I'm so glad we got to talk about things like Scream, Saw, The Last of Us, Flanagan, Eli Roth, some great things in there, some of our favorite things. So even though we said it's a quiet year, we still got to talk about plenty of people and franchises that we adore. So that's the great thing about the genre. But yeah, any parting words?
No, I think we've done it, man. I think we've done it. I think that's 2023, and we'll see what 2024 holds. It's going to be a new journey for the podcast.
It is indeed. But yeah, as always, whether it was just this one or any of the other 373 episodes, thanks for listening, as always. And we'll see you again, hopefully, very soon.
See you later, everyone. Shut up, I can't. Mainly because I never could. And how could I?